now. Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about the deadline that is quickly approaching for states to decide if they're going to set up their own health care exchange, whether they're going to partner with the federal government to have a mutual exchange, or if they're going to allow the federal government to impose their exchange. That deadline coming nearer, so like it or not, Obamacare is coming. The question is, what will our governor do? Personally, I'm kind of hoping that he does nothing and we get the federal program until Corbett goes. Because I don't think anything that this administration touches will amount to a hill of beans for working people. I think it'll be another screw job set up, well, to keep profiting to the same folks who are profiting off of it right now. And speaking of profits, corporate profits have never been better. But workers in the nation, they're stuck holding the bag. What can we do to level that playing field? Well, there are a number of groups out there advocating for something called a Robin Hood tax, or simply a sales tax on transactions. Sell stock, pay a simple tax. Seems reasonable. In fact, we used to do it until the neoliberals took power. We should be getting that back. We're going to talk about that. Also, education privatization, all the rage in the corporate world. We're going to find out who's pushing it. And, well, what can we do about it? And, of course, later in the program, you're going to find out what Tricky Ricky Santorum's up to. Evidently found a new job. You will definitely want to stay around and find out who he'll be shilling for up until the next failed presidential adventure. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So last week, we found out that North Korea had unearthed a unicorn. They have found the mythical unicorn. It is, at least they're saying, hey, we found it. The myth, big sign above the lair, the unicorn's lair. Unicorn, here. Well, evidently here in this country, the Republicans have found the revenue fairy. So you got the North Koreans with the unicorn, Republicans with the revenue fairy. Because if you look at the plan that they just laid out, you have to believe in fairies if you buy what they've put forward. You have to believe in magic, that this revenue, this mythical revenue is just going to come flowing from nowhere. Their counter proposal to what Obama ran on, $800 billion in new revenue. And you go, well, how are we going to, what do you mean new revenue? Oh, we'll tell you later. The fairy's going to do it. Little magic dust, little pixel dust. Loopholes, mostly, they claim. Won't say which loopholes, won't say what deductions, but hey, yeah, trust us. Checks in the mail. They're going to get $900 billion in health care and other mandatory spending cuts, which means, you know, those programs that help the poor and the elderly, cut, gut, and punish. Also $300 billion from discretionary spending, which, again, you go back to who's that we're talking about? Oh, yeah, those people on food stamps. If you saw the story in the paper today, food stamps in affluent areas, you bet you're behind. Because we're all hurting thanks to well, this is the Reagan economy. This is what the Reaganites envisioned, a service-based, low-waged economy with a division of wealth that goes exponentially to the top, and the folks at the bottom, well, we fight over the crumbs. Also, they're going to save $200 billion, according to the Republicans, and changing how they calculate cost of living adjustments for both Social Security and Medicare. Again, who does that hit? Well, that hits my grandmother. It's working age people. It hurts those people who they're limping to get to the retirement age because I know a lot of folks, they're praying to make it to Medicare. And now the Republicans want to move that off to 67. They want to change the way Social Security is calculated so it's a lower benefit. And again, you look at this and you go, where's the revenue coming from? Where's this revenue fairy? Where's the magic dust? Oh, yeah, it's you, it's me. It's people like us who are struggling. They're going to take more. Why? Because we don't really have a voice. These politicians, these elected people, they come to us every election time. Oh, please vote for us because the other guy sucks. And look what they do. They pander to the people who gave them the money. The Republicans are dug in. They are dug knee deep. They're dug in over their head. They actually cannot raise taxes on the wealthy without being just slammed by the wealth class. And they know it. They've allowed themselves to be backed into a corner. Now, the Democrats are saying, look, and trust me, the Democrats, they'll cave on their own. But I'm hoping that someone will say, no, you have to raise that top marginal rate. You have to. Because we know what's going to happen again. Those loopholes that they claim they're going to close, if they ever name them, if they ever decide to tell us which ones, and I'll tell you which ones they're going to go after. The home mortgage deduction, got to close that off. So, you know, middle-class families, they're not going to get that. The earned income tax credit, the child credit, you know, those things, they'll go after that. Much like they did in 86 when they began taxing unemployment for the first time. But to me, the most egregious, to me, the biggest slap in the face in this proposal is that $300 billion in spending cuts for discretionary spending that they want. That's the food stamps. That's how we feed people in this country, like it or not. Like it or not, those at the bottom, and I remember as a kid growing up, if it weren't for those food stamps, we would have starved. And because things were much different back then. I look at it and I say, well, we've got these food banks. Yeah, you had them back then, and maybe you could eke out an existence, but not in the mass numbers that by gutting this kind of money from this food stamp program, you couldn't, the churches and the food banks, they would never make up the difference. And to me, again, you look at it and the Republicans don't care. It's just about protecting that top 2%, protecting the wealth. And I watched some of the shows over the weekend, and Geithner caught my attention. He was out with Chris Wallace on Fox Sunday. And Wallace said, you know, the last question, can you promise that we will never go over the cliff? And Geithner says, no, I can't promise that. That's a decision that lies in the hands of the Republicans. That are now opposing increases in tax rates. If they recognize the reality that we cannot afford to extend the tax rates, we have the basis for an agreement that would be good for the American people. He says, why does it make sense for the country to force tax increases on all Americans because of a small group of Republicans wanting to extend for that top 2%? And he's right. Why does that make any sense? Because here's the thing. If you go back to the rationale for giving those tax breaks to the very top, if you go back to that and you listen to what Bush said, we're going to give this $550 billion tax break and it's going to create 1 million new jobs. Even if you got over the fact that it's $550,000 per job to create just one job, $550,000, even if you got over the price tag shock, you have to realize it didn't happen. That million jobs never materialized. So not only did it was it supposed to only cost us $550 million per job, that million never materialized. So why just from a rational standpoint, why would we continue to give that $550,000 for the job that never materialized into the future? Is it that we hope that at some point it may? Do you think that at some point, you know, they're going to have to? Well, you know, we're going to have to because, you know, eventually the jig will be up. Eventually they'll find us out. I mean, really, will we ever wake up to the reality that handing out huge amounts of money to the very, very wealthy is not going to create jobs? Look, if you buy that whole argument, well, they earned it, they should be able to keep it, that's one thing. But if you're making the argument that we need to get money into the hands of the job creators, that's another. And the Republicans have taken, well, they've really tried to do both. But they've sold it to most people on the, well, they know what to do with the money. They're going to create jobs, even though they haven't. And you look at this whole fiscal mirage. You look at this whole setup, this whole gig that the Republicans have put forth. I mean, there have just been some really, they think we're stupid. I mean, it comes down to that. I think Boehner and I think the rest of the Republicans think the electorate in this country is just dumb. If you remember when Obama came out with his initial outline, said, this is what I want. These are the cuts and this is the stuff that we're willing to do. And this is the stuff we're really not willing to do. We're not going to let you not let those tax rates return to where they were. It didn't work. Your experiment failed. We need a reset, which is what was supposed to happen with the Bush tax cuts anyway. There was a sunset provision, just how it was. 2010, a decade, it was supposed to go away. 2010 was done. So I found it interesting last week when Boehner said he was flabbergasted. I was surprised. It was just a miracle. He says, you can't be serious. I've never seen anything like it. Playing this card that, well, nobody, who could have expected that a plan like this would ever come out? Who could have possibly thought of it? My first thought was, did you miss the entire presidential campaign? I mean, this is what Obama ran on. He was very, you know, there's a lot of times where I'll give him the grief that he deserves, but he ran on this. We're going to raise those top 2%. We're going to raise those back to where they were. In fact, he put it in his 20-page plan back in October for everybody to see. Laid out tax breaks for the middle class. Laid out business tax cuts for small business. Also went into some entitlement savings that, you know, some of the cuts I don't know that I'm thrilled with. But Boehner's flabbergasted, shocked, didn't know it was coming. You know, that 20-page report that Orrin Hatch called a glossy brochure and nothing but a rehash of the same failed policies of the past 4 years? Remember that? So you have to look at this and go, so? Either John Boehner is a great actor, Academy Award-winning actor, or his eyes are brown. Because he's full of it up to there. I'm leaning towards the eyes are brown because he's full of it. At the end of the day, what has to happen is we've got to raise those rates. It's got to happen. The math doesn't work any other way. And I look at today's proposal. Again, the ferry. Do you remember the entire campaign? Where the Republicans ran on the, and it's laughable that we even entertained the idea that they would be the people who saved Medicare. But you remember the whole little whiteboard thing that Romney did where he did the, you know, the little squeaky, you know, the Sharpie on the whiteboard saying, we're going to put all $716 billion back into Medicare. Remember that? We're going to be the champions of Medicare. So explain to me why it is part of their proposal, you know, to keep us from going over their cliff is cutting Medicare. Because I guess I just don't understand that. And by an awful lot. In fact, Tennessee Senator Bob Corker was on Meet the Depressed. He said that he had laid out a very detailed, painful, very painful plan that cuts Medicare. He said, we really have to look much deeper to reforming entitlements. You know, that Social Security and that Medicare. I don't think it's any surprise to anyone that the Republicans are anti-Medicare and anti-Medicaid. because they spend an awful lot of time wanting to destroy it. I got to be honest with you, though. I'm in favor of opening those up, expanding them even further. Because it makes no sense to me that we take care of the sickest and we take care of the youngest and the oldest and allow the insurance companies to profit off of the healthy everybody else. It makes no sense. And it makes no sense to rational thinking people. Even the people I know who hate Obamacare, they have no answer for our current system. So I say let's get this started. When we come back and talk a little bit about Medicaid, and there's a rally coming on. I guess it's tomorrow in Philly at noon, but we're going to talk about that. Also, the exchange, what that's going to look like here in Pennsylvania. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A coalition of progressives, unions, and environmentalists is campaigning to change the U.S. Senate's filibuster rules, something Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid wants to do. President Obama supports Reid's efforts as well. What Reid has in mind is to eliminate the filibuster vote needed to officially start debate on legislation. Reid also wants to require senators who use the filibuster to actually spend it talking on the Senate floor. The Communications Workers of America supports the filibuster reform. Shane Larson is legislative director for the CWA.
The Senate can't even debate any bills anymore. They're not even allowed to bring up a bill for an actual honest, good old-fashioned debate. You know, the state that this country's in, with the number of issues that we have confronting us, our legislative bodies have to function.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is warning Reid that changing the filibuster rules would be toxic for bipartisan relations. It's not clear how that is any different from what's been happening already, with Republicans routinely using the filibuster to obstruct majority-supported legislation without having to exert any effort with marathon speeches on the Senate floor. Senator Reid says the reforms are just common sense. SEIU and other supporters are rallying around a Mexican man falsely arrested and now facing deportation under the Secure Communities program. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Union members waved their purple and gold flags and chanted encouragement for Jose Maria Islas, a 34-year-old Mexican who was falsely arrested for stealing a bicycle and held for 4 months. Then he was released by a judge into the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which is trying to deport him under the Secure Communities program. He is now charged with 2 misdemeanors and was held for an additional month in detention in Massachusetts. He still faces deportation, even though ICE's own policy is to target violent criminals and those who pose a security threat. Matt O'Connor, political director of the Connecticut District of 32BJ, which represents many immigrant workers in building maintenance, emceed the rally. First, he introduced Mike Lawler, Governor Daniel Malloy's criminal justice advisor, who has spoken out against ICE targeting of low-level offenders or those with no criminal record, like Islas, before he was arrested on the false charge.
We're concerned because the perception in the immigrant community that cooperating with the police is an invitation to be deported for you or your family members or your friends. If victims of crime and if witnesses to crime are afraid to cooperate with local law enforcement, then our entire public safety system will break down.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Hartford, Connecticut.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door, there's holds the throne. Heaven looking for the map that leads me home. I've been somewhere on good hearts turning to stone. The road of good intentions is gone dry as a bone. We take care of our own.
Welcome back to the Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, from data compiled by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they show that that Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act has already saved about 5.2 million seniors and people with disabilities in this country, somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 billion on their prescription drugs by closing that donut hole that they put right there in the middle. You know, you look at this, and again, you know, you go back and you look at all of the money that's been saved by seniors to this point. The administration announced that they had surpassed $5 million that they had gotten back to folks, something like $677 per American on their prescription so far just this year. And you go back and you go, oh, wow, nobody told me that. And, you know, I've talked about the conversations I had with people who all they hear is the misinformation. You know, you look at this pay-or-die system we have that we had, this is a step in the right direction. And tomorrow, from what I understand, there's going to be a rally in Philadelphia at noon in front of Senator Casey's office to get him to say, hey, you know what, we're going to stand up and we're not going to do what the Republicans want and push Medicare off to 67 or change how we calculate Social Security or go after any of those programs just yet. Maybe we should be looking at the top of the economic scale first. But I've asked Erin Gill-Ninehouse, she's Education and Outreach Coordinator with the Western Pennsylvania Pennsylvania Health Access Network, PAHealthAccess.org, the website. Erin, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you so much, Rick, for having me on.
So this rally tomorrow, what's the point?
So the point is to show Senator Casey that we are not going to roll over for steep cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, and also to thank him because he's really been an ally and an advocate to protect retirement security for seniors. He's really spoken out for Medicaid and Medicare and the Affordable Care Act in the past. We want to thank him for his leadership and also urge him to, you know, stand strong during these budget negotiations and not get pushed around, because that's what the election was about, right? I mean, folks, you know, came out and worked hard to send a message and to advance the things that we value, like, you know, grandparents and kids and health care and retirement security. So that's what tomorrow is about. It's at noon, Senator Casey's office, 20th and Market in Philadelphia.
You know, I look at the Republican counterproposal today that, you know, like I said at the beginning, the North Koreans found the unicorn, evidently found a unicorn. We found the revenue fairy, because what they threw out today, this $800 billion in new revenue, don't know where it's coming from, but it's new. Also, $900 billion in health care and mandatory spending cuts. That's Medicare. That's Medicaid. That's stuff that helped the poor. $300 billion in discretionary spending cuts. That's food stamps. I look at all of this, $200 billion they're going to steal from people getting Social Security and Medicare, and I go, well, whose side are the Republicans on in this? I mean, look at all of the attacks to working poor people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And what's really really wild, and I think why they don't want to actually spell this out in any detail, is that essentially what they're proposing is the Ryan budget all over again. And that would essentially destroy Medicaid as we know it. It would turn into a block grant program, which means that, you know, you get a set amount of money for your state, and when that money runs out, you know, too bad. You know, you would either have to raise taxes, restrict care, cut payments to providers, and most of Medicaid in Pennsylvania, a lot of folks don't understand Medicaid, or maybe if you don't have an interaction with it, you think that it's something that will never touch you, but it actually is the main way that most middle-class seniors afford long-term care and care in a nursing home. So, you know, when Medicaid funds are cut and Medicare is cut, patients are hurt, you know, immediately. Biggest costs for long-term care facilities are staffing and supplies. So you've got healthcare workers taking a hit in their pay or doing twice the amount of work, spending less time with your grandfather, your grandmother. And that's a scary situation, and it's totally unnecessary. So, you know, the Republicans are coming out with the same stuff they always come out with. You know, ask the most of those who have the least, and nothing of those that have the most and have gotten all the breaks for the past, you know, certainly the past, 30 years.
Yeah, you know, I look at it, they're going after the people who are basically defenseless, the ones who can't fight and stand up for themselves, which is why I think it's so great that you're going to have this rally tomorrow to give Senator Casey a spine, but also to send the message to Senator Toomey, who I guess just had a piece out in the newspaper today saying how he's, well, we don't want to raise taxes on those rich people. We need to go after, well, same as always, go after the poor people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I saw it from Senator Toomey today, and he's, you know, it's amazing that he just continues to refuse to even acknowledge what a majority of Pennsylvanians want and believe, and showed that, you know, less than a month ago in the election, that we need a balanced approach that includes a fair and reasonable amount of revenue from the top 2%. Senator Toomey said he's only open to closing loopholes and reducing deductions if we cut rates on top earners and capital gains and also slash spending. So, you know, I was going to say he's beholden to Grover Norquist, not the people who sent him to Washington, but that's actually not right if you look at how much money those corporate interest groups like the Club for Growth, which he left, you know, to run for Senate, spent to get him in there. So, you know, I called his office last week about this, talked to the staffer. It's clear that they're totally tuned out. You know, they're blinded by ideology, and they're determined to really take it out of the hide of seniors and working people. And, you know, we've you know, got to send the message. And I think Senator Casey has really stood with us on this, and he can, you know, take the enthusiasm and the energy and the contacts and the calls that we put into him and take that to the Senate and show that, you know, we're not going to roll over for these cuts.
And the hope is that he brings this up in the fiscal mirage hearings that they're going to have in the next couple of days, because you look at the numbers. I mean, the woman who just cut my hair the other day, you know, just, she had a stroke, didn't have health insurance, didn't, you know, somebody who works extremely hard, but couldn't afford insurance. She's got a pre-existing condition, and it's just all, this is the kind of legislation. Obamacare is exactly what she needed years ago. And, you know, she was telling me, well, you know, I've been told it's a bad thing, and I've been told, you know, this and that. And all of it's wrong, but it's what she's been told, and it's what the right has done masterfully of drum beating in her ear that this isn't going to help her. But this could have potentially stopped her from having a stroke in the first place by getting her some preventative care.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I talk to people all the time in similar situations. I talk to a woman who's a special ed aide at a school district in suburban Pittsburgh who lost function in one of her kidneys, and she had insurance, but it was so limited. It didn't offer any specialist visits. You know, she used up her regular visits, and she finally ended up in the emergency room when she couldn't wait any longer and lost function in one of her kidneys. So, you know, this is the kind of stuff where it has a horrible human cost, but it also doesn't make any sense. If we want to, you know, get healthcare, you know, costs under control in the long term, we can't let folks walk around like ticking time bombs, you know, with out of control or undiagnosed illnesses that eventually, when they turn Medicare age, we're going to be paying for as a society. I mean, it's wrong and awful, but it also doesn't make any sense. So the Medicaid expansion is hugely important, and that's actually still a wild card. We don't know whether or not Governor Corbett is going to, you know, accept that or reject it. A lot of red state governors have said no, they don't want it. And if Governor Corbett turns it down, that would just be a devastating blow to about 500,000 people who would be covered in Pennsylvania.
And who are those? Who are those people? I mean, when you talk about Medicaid, it's those lazy people.
Right.
But who is it really when we're talking about cutting Medicaid? Who is it we're talking about?
Well, when we talk about cutting Medicaid, we're talking about cutting seniors' health care. We're talking about cutting kids and newborns. And we're talking about cutting people with disabilities and the services that they need to live with dignity and independently at home. So that's what we're talking about. It's incredibly hard to qualify for Medicaid right now in Pennsylvania. You have to have very young children, have a very serious illness, have a disability, or be a low-income senior, or be a senior receiving long-term care. So if you're just working part-time, you know, working poor, you know, trying to piece it together, you can't qualify for Medicaid. You know, that doesn't stop, you know, people on, you know, right-wing talk radio from saying otherwise, but the reality is that it's very difficult to qualify for, and under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, Medicaid would be expanded to folks up into the minimum wage range. So right now, if you're working for minimum wage in Pennsylvania, you would qualify for the Medicaid expansion and finally not have to worry about, you know, McDonald's health care or any of the other awful choices that people have to make when you're stuck and you don't get, you know, you're not offered insurance through your employer. So that's who we're talking about. You know, the cuts have an immediate impact on seniors, families, kids, and also the health care workers and the communities that provide that care. They also take a hit. That's jobs lost, that's economic activity that's not happening. But the expansion is just a huge piece of the puzzle. And folks really need to contact Corbett about that.
Yeah, I mean, and call his office early and often because he's also in charge of, you know, he's got a couple of decisions to make by December 14th. He's got to decide if the state of Pennsylvania is going to have an exchange set up by the state or if they're going to come up with a mishmash between a state and a federal program or if they're just going to let the federal government take it over. And I got to be honest with you, Aaron, I'm kind of leaning towards, Tom, don't do anything. Just let the federal government impose whatever it is because I don't think anything that the Republicans in this state set up will benefit people who need it. I just don't.
Yeah, well, they actually released their first draft of what they wanted to do, you know, with this exchange, which is supposed to be a better, more competitive, easier to navigate marketplace, a simple path to get from point A, which is not having coverage, to point B, which is having good coverage, getting the tax credit under the law, you know, and going on your way. But their first draft would have set up multiple exchanges around the state, given all the power to insurance companies, and it was awful. So, you know, to hear that they're thinking about not doing it and that they've kind of cooled to the idea is not the worst thing that could happen, honestly, for families. You know, we at the beginning thought that it would be best for Pennsylvania to be in charge and really know what to set up, understanding the needs of our state. But if that's what they're going to do, I think, you know, folks probably will be better off, you know, letting the Department of Health and Human Services handle it.
Yeah, I mean, because I think of the woman who cuts my hair, who just a hardworking woman who has always worked and, you know, went this time period because she couldn't afford health insurance. Her business was struggling. You know, she just couldn't get it. And she had to wait until she was in the hospital having a stroke before she could get Medicare. Just to highlight what you were saying a second ago, that you just don't get it. You've got to be really sick. And she was on her deathbed before she got the care that she needed, which is just dumb to me. It would have been better to prevent her getting to that point by preventing her high blood pressure and going getting some preventative screenings early. But I guess that's not as profitable as it could be, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's just devastating when you look at chronic illnesses like heart disease and diabetes and cancer, to think that someone is walking around, you know, essentially like a ticking time bomb, and to know what that's like, or to have someone in your family that you know they're getting up and, God forbid, if they have a fender bender or, you know, if they have a headache or a strange feeling, they can't get it checked out. You know, they can't afford to know what's wrong with them. And it has, you know, an awful cost on families, but also, you know, it just makes no sense long term. And just in Pennsylvania, just to put it in simple terms, because we throw around like billions of dollars, and I think a lot of folks, you know, our minds tend to glaze over at those big numbers. But, you know, Pennsylvania, in accepting the Medicaid expansion, would get $9 back for every dollar that we invested, and at the same time cover 500,000 people. So it is a win-win all around. It's a great deal. It makes all kinds of sense. It's funded. It'll spur economic activity and grow jobs in our state while covering people and while improving the health of our population and building a healthy workforce that employers want. Governor Corbett would be crazy to turn it down, but if he's being driven by, you know, the far-right people in the party,
yep,
that's, you know, that's where he could go.
Yeah, but I go back to my barber situation, and she, you know, look, to me, it just makes perfect. We used to understand it. You know, the guy Benjamin Franklin used to say, an ounce of prevention, pound of cure. We used to get that. Now not so much, because we have this for-profit pay-or-die system. And I look at, you know, some of the things that I've seen. You know, the Medicaid, you know, covers, what, about half of all the births of
yeah.
kids in this state. About 35% of the kids rely on it for their primary health care. Explain to me why it is that we've got a system set up that where people actually use health care the first 5 years, and the last 5 years, it's okay to have a system where we, the taxpayers, are the ones responsible for it, and the private for-profit companies, well, they're not.
Yeah,
it doesn't
make
a lot of sense to me.
No, I mean, if you wanted to set out and make a more dysfunctional health care system, I don't think you could, because it absolutely makes no sense. Like you said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's so simple, and that's what just drives me nuts about this, is that, you know, these are not big complex ideas. You know, these are simple choices about what we value and what we don't. Do we value healthy families and security? You know, healthcare security is key, you know, to a strong middle class and to a functioning, you know, democracy and country, and we can get there. You know, Obamacare is the law of the land, right? It was not repealed. You know, upheld by the Supreme Court. It was affirmed again in the last election. It's not a political liability to those who supported it. It's here to stay. And Governor Corbett and those who are continuing to try to pick it apart and tear it down just need to stop. I mean, people are fed up with it. It's just not, it's not the right way to go. It's not helpful. It's bad for business, the economy, families, everybody. It just makes no sense.
That makes no sense to me whatsoever. So last line of questioning I've got, you know, how do we get involved? What should we be doing in these coming days to make sure that, one, our senator stands up and fights for these folks, and two, these exchanges and the stuff going forward goes the right way? What should we be doing?
Well, call their offices, tweet them, you know, get on social media. A good starting place is our website, just pahealthaccess.org. Right on the homepage, we'll have all the different links to take action. It's at Senator I'm sorry, it's at SEN Bob Casey and at SEN Toomey on Twitter. Call their offices, get all over them on social media and on Facebook and on Twitter. Contact us, contact me. My phone number is 412-512-9225. If you have questions or you know someone in your family who's on Medicare or Medicaid or who's uninsured, we're here to help and try to, you know, get folks what they need connected with care right now, and also, you know, help folks make their voices heard to make sure that we get this right in the coming weeks and months.
And you can contact me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com, and I will make sure that you get to Aaron Gill Neinhauser. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Education and Outreach Coordinator for Pennsylvania Health Access Network, PAHealthAccess.org, the website. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Wanna lift you up, oh, wanna rock, rock, feel the morning down. Morning John.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Now we must consider the forthcoming celebrations in Washington for President Obama's January inauguration. Really, we must. Unfortunately, we have to discuss this national, profoundly symbolic public event because Obama advisors are urging him to privatize it. They want him to let favor-seeking corporations put up tens of millions of dollars to pay for assorted inaugural balls, concerts, and parties. As Rob Wiseman of the always vigilant watchdog group Public Citizen succinctly says, this is a patently horrible idea. In 2009, Obama rightly rejected corporate donations for his first inaugural, but his advisors are now making a perverse argument that because this is a civic event, quote, corporate citizens should be invited to buy into the dance, just as they do when buying naming rights to public museums and ballparks. Come on, Obama. We'd expect Mitt Romney to allow that, but someone needs to shout out a loud no, not one step further to the rampaging commercialization of all things public. The inauguration of an American president is a uniquely public ceremony, symbolizing our people's commitment to the democratic transference of power. To stain that with crass special interest money is an insult to the very idea of America. And a corporate-purchased inaugural would be compounded this time because it'll take place on January 21. That very day will mark the third anniversary of the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United decree that corporations should be allowed to buy our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, if Obama does give in to the money, he should have to take the oath of office in a suit and tie emblazoned, like a NASCAR driver, with the logos of his sponsoring corporations. Tell Obama to keep his inaugural corporate free. 202-456-1111.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Congressional Budget Office has estimated that if the full range of tax increases and spending cuts were allowed to take effect, a scenario widely referred to as the fiscal cliff, a shallow recession would occur early next year.
Just a mirage. That's all you are to me. Just a mirage. The matter only sees.
Well, you know, if you go over the so-called mirage, over the grand cliff, you know, this... I was listening to some of the right-wing blather on the way in today, and, you know, they're already, you know, pointing at Obama. Ah, see, Obama wants us. He wants us to go over the big cliff, you know, and Obama created the cliff, and he made the cliff, and it's his fault. And, you know, it's like they've already got the marching orders that the Republicans, they know they can't win this round because, well, public opinion is well against them. People are saying, you know what, we've given too much to the very top. Maybe it's time now that we start looking at, oh, I don't know, asking them to do a little bit of something. Just a thought. And I think they know this. So what they've got their minions out there doing the march going, you know, hey, it's Obama's fault. Everything's his fault. It's all the black guy in the White House. It's his fault. He wants us to go down because he's a Muslim and he's this and he's that. And I'm going, well, didn't we just have an election where people said, hey, you know, you guys have bad ideas. Your ideas are bad. They don't work. Your ideas are what got us into this. And our quote of the day comes from U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, who said, think about the arrogance of these guys on Wall Street who were bailed out by the middle class of this country when their greed and recklessness nearly destroyed the financial system. And now they come to Capitol Hill to lecture Congress and the American people about the need to cut programs for working families. This is what class warfare is all about. And, you know, it is. And I've always asked, why is it that, you know, when I point out how the wealth in this country is attacking the working people. People say, oh, it's class warfare. And how I say, you know, we need to raise taxes before we cut programs for the poor. We need to ask from the top before we take from the bottom. Why is that class warfare? I mean, the right has done a masterful job saying, well, those are takers and those people at the top, they're the producers. Yet when you really look at it, who are the big takers? Well, the big takers are the CEO class, the wealth class, the people who benefit wildly from government largesse. Blows the mind. I mean, Alan Grayson's right. You want to talk about the biggest recipient of public aid in this country? It's a little someone named Walmart. And at some point, we've got to stop allowing ourselves to be sliced and diced and divided and pitted against one another. And start looking at where the real problems are. So I heard an interesting comment. A Republican from Tennessee, a guy named John Duncan. He was on a right-wing talk show, and the guy asked him, hey, wouldn't it be prudent for Republicans to gently begin urging their citizens to return to gold? I'm going, gold? I thought we got rid of that. Well, according to Duncan, yes, I agree with you completely. We should do that. The best way to protect our money and keep us from facing things, like I mentioned, like our pensions and so forth, gold. I'm going, really? Do you know what that would do to our economy? Do you know what kind of constriction you would have? This is a way out idea. Something that even Uncle Milty, the guy that they base all of their economic worldview on, Milton Friedman, was opposed to. But, you know, that sounds, well, like they actually understand their ideology. The gold standard, throwing that out there, that fits on a bumper sticker. The other actually takes some thought. And I look at what you saw on Chris Wallace on the Fox News Sunday, had John Boehner on there. And, you know, he asked about, you know, the question that I said, you know, the president ran on raising taxes on the wealthy. So it was a big issue. I mean, it was the issue between Romney and Obama. And he said that, you know, after the victory, you know, it just came. And he says, look, you know, you're going to have to go and you're going to have to raise taxes. And Boehner cut him off and said, listen, what's the difference where the money comes from? What's the difference if the money comes from the wealthy or if it comes from the poor? He says, we put up $800 billion worth of revenue. The question then becomes, who are we talking about? And the revenue fairy hasn't decided yet. Is this going to be cuts from my grandmother's Social Security? Is this going to be cuts from future benefits for Medicare and those things that people like me benefit from, so that we can keep those higher folks getting the tax handouts? And I guess it's a fundamental difference between the Boehners and the Republicans, because look, Boehner's in a tough spot, because Boehner wants to cut a deal. He doesn't. He's a wheeler and a dealer. He's not generally someone who's a staunch ideologue. But the party and the money and all of these front group tinky tanks, they've really boxed him in. And I know, oh, Rick, you're making him sound like a decent guy. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is he's somebody who he wants to cut a deal. He doesn't want to be put in a position that he knows Republicans are going to lose on this. They are absolutely going to lose if the Democrats don't cap. If Democrats stand their ground and say, we are not doing any of those draconian things, we're not slashing Medicare, we're not going after Social Security, until that top 2%, that rate's back where it was. It's a non-starter, and I think Obama has been very clear on this. It's a non-starter to take the position that we're not going to raise those rates. Everything else after that, I guess, then can be discussed. And that's where I would start with if I were the Democrats. And I think it's where Obama's kind of staked his ground. My problem is I think that they will move. But for me, you stake the ground of, look, it's a non-starter. The American people have spoken. 60% of the people have said, look, raise those rates. And I got to be honest, I think it's got to be higher than that. Because I've yet to find anyone, even my most staunchly conservative right-wing ideologue who listens to all of the right-wing soup and all of the blather and all of the brainwashing and all of that, to them it doesn't make any sense. Because they fall back on, you know, the right has created this crisis, this ticking bomb. You know, we're saddled with massive debt. We can't afford this and that. We can't afford to invest in roads and bridges. And you got people who are even, you know, the most right-wing ideologues I know going, it just doesn't make sense that we're going to continue to give money to people who aren't investing it here. And for me, I go back and I say, you know what? We should be going back to a much higher, you know, we're arguing about the Clinton tax code. We should be arguing about the Eisenhower or the Kennedy or even when Reagan took office, that tax code. Going back to that, and then incentivizing on top of that. But no one's got the political courage to bring that up. And we're just talking about going back to the Clinton rates, in the hopes that maybe we'll go back to that prosperity. Now, I think the revenue brought in from going back to the Clinton years, not a bad idea, but I don't know that that's enough. Because these last couple of years, we've had to really dig deep, get out of the crisis that was created by bad policy on the right. Something we're going to have to really, and I'm hoping the Democrats hold. I'm hoping that they stand firm on, look, it's a non-starter in my view. Before you're going to take money from my grandmother, before you're going to take from children, before you're going to take food out of the mouths of people, I'm sorry. It just makes no sense to me to cut food stamps or Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security while we're ensuring that the very wealthy and the very well-heeled stay that way. Makes no sense. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
They might not go out and buy a shiny sports car, but chimpanzees and orangutans can experience a midlife crisis, just as humans do.
That's according to a study published in late 2012 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It suggests that, as in humans, chimpanzee and orangutan happiness follows a U-shape that is high in youth, falls in middle age, and rises again into old age.
A team of primatologists and psychologists from Japan and the United States studied 508 great apes in zoos and sanctuaries across the world. Keepers, volunteers, researchers, and caretakers who knew the apes well were asked to assess their well-being. The apes' happiness was scored with a series of measures adapted from human subjective well-being measures.
The researchers are trying to understand why human happiness follows an approximate U-shape through life. They said their study of apes showed that it can't just be because of mortgages, marital breakup, or mobile phones. Apes also have a pronounced midlife low, and they have none of those.
The team points out that their findings don't rule out the possibility that economic events or social and cultural forces contribute to the well-being U-shape in a human lifespan.
But these researchers say their study suggests a need to consider evolutionary or biological explanations as well. That's our show for today, made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So I was reading an article over at The Patriot, and the headline reading, Mid-State Sees Rise in Food Stamp Usage Even Among More Affluent Areas. And look, it's, you know, this area is no different than anywhere else in the country. The jobs are just not here. And, you know, at least not the good family-sustaining jobs. And they point to a couple of people, like this 72-year-old guy who has worked in the food service industry for 57 years. He is still working, you know, in the food industry. Look, I mean, it's not a high-paying gig. In fact, he's on Social Security, about $500 a month. That's not enough to live on. He's still got to work. So he got his last job at age 68. He's had a knee operation. He's hoping that his employer keeps him, but he's standing in line at a food bank instead of doing something that, you know, you'd want to do in retirement. He's at, you know, you got all these people who need food stamps, and you've got the Republicans who, their budget, what's it do? Well, they want to slash things like this. $300 billion they want to take out of these programs. And, you know, it just blows my mind. And what's even more interesting to me is this Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. He has and made a lot of hay. There's been a lot of political hay made about his week. I guess he's going to spend a week trying to make ends meet on what food stamps would pay for, which, according to the article, is about $1.40 a meal, somewhere around $4 a day. I guess it has gone up a little. When I did it, it was $3 a day, and we did it for 2 weeks. And I'll tell you, it wasn't any good for it. But Politico pointed out what it is that he was going, what his meals were going to be. And it's kind of interesting. And you stop and you think about, what's all entailed and what you're going to afford. I guess for breakfast, he's going to have one 6 ounce Strawberry and banana Yoplait yogurt, 99 cents. An 8-ounce carton of Tropicana orange juice, 39 cents for $1.38. That's it. Nutritional value, about 290 calories. 57 grams of carb, 1.5 fat. He's all for lunch. He's going to have a 1 8-ounce Eat Right frozen meatball sandwich, $1, and 1 2-ounce package of Safeway carrots, 57 cents. Then for dinner, a sandwich with 2 Safeway bread slices, 2 Kraft slices of cheese, and Oscar Mayer turkey slices, $1.24. And they go through and they look at, you know, how much fat, how much protein. And at the end of it, you go, one, it's a high-fat diet, high-carbohydrate diet. And you wonder why, you know, why are those people on food stamps, why are they obese? Well, because they're filling up on carbs. Horrible. They're filling up on fat. And the guy we talked to the other day about the fast food industry, we have got an entire industry propping up around feeding poor people the worst possible food you can eat. But I look at this thing with Booker. A lot of political hay. The hope is that it turns about more than just about Cory Booker. It turns about the issue. Because this stuff that they're pointing out, these meals that they've, 2 hot dogs, you get 2 wieners from Safeway and a Safeway bun, 26 grams of fat, almost 300 calories just for the, you can't long-term exist on this. We need to be talking about how do we make sure that folks at the lower end of the economic scale get decent. I remember when I did it, and I remember being just sluggish and worn out and starving. I mean, I got to be honest with you, $3 a day at the time was not a lot. And imagine trying to feed a family, trying to feed kids, especially teenagers. And what the right paints these food stamp programs are, oh, it's a lap of luxury. Never, never, it's never been better. Like, this is some kind of utopian society that people who live in, like where I grew up, living in the projects, getting food stamps, and at the end of the month, it running out. Because, yeah, they give you the food stamps at the beginning of the month, and you fill up your freezer, you fill up your refrigerator, but that last week, that last 2 weeks, there's nothing there. And in this country, I got to be honest, the last thing any child should ever do is go to the cupboards and have there be nothing there. And what do we got? We got a political party in this country who wants to gut $300 billion at a time when we're 20 million jobs short. We should be investing heavily in infrastructure. We should be investing heavily in full employment. And at the end of it, government should be the employer of last resort if you can't find a job doing anything else, because a job has some real therapeutic qualities. And I want that for everybody. But again, what we've got is we've got a political party who's saying, hell no, we're not doing it. Doing nothing. Have we seen any transportation bills? Have we seen any infrastructure investment bills, any jobs bills, any plan to get the economy moving? Not a bit. Going to take a quick break. If you missed any portion of the first hour, therickssmithshow.com. You can get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. Back with hour two. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A coalition of progressives, unions, and environmentalists is campaigning to change the U.S. Senate's filibuster rules, something Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid wants to do. President Obama supports Reid's efforts as well. What Reid has in mind is to eliminate the filibuster vote needed to officially start debate on legislation. Reid also wants to require senators who use the filibuster to actually spend it talking on the Senate floor. The Communications Workers of America supports the filibuster reform. Shane Larson is legislative director for the CWA.
The Senate can't even debate any bills anymore. They're not even allowed to bring up a bill for an actual honest, good old-fashioned debate. You know, the state that this country's in, with the number of issues that we have confronting us, our legislative bodies have to function.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is warning Reid that changing the filibuster rules would be toxic for bipartisan relations. It's not clear how that is any different from what's been happening already, with Republicans routinely using the filibuster to obstruct majority-supported legislation without having to exert any effort with marathon speeches on the Senate floor. Senator Reid says the reforms are just common sense. SEIU and other supporters are rallying around a Mexican man falsely arrested and now facing deportation under the Secure Communities program. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Union members waved their purple and gold flags and chanted encouragement for Jose Maria Islas, a 34-year-old Mexican who was falsely arrested for stealing a bicycle and held for 4 months. Then he was released by a judge into the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which is trying to deport him under the Secure Communities program. He is now charged with 2 misdemeanors and was held for an additional month in detention in Massachusetts. He still faces deportation, even though ICE's own policy is to target violent criminals and those who pose a security threat. Matt O'Connor, political director of the Connecticut District of 32BJ, which represents many immigrant workers in building maintenance, emceed the rally. First, he introduced Mike Lawler, Governor Daniel Malloy's criminal justice advisor, who has spoken out against ICE targeting of low-level offenders or those with no criminal record, like Islas before he was arrested on the false charge.
We're concerned because the perception in the immigrant community that cooperating with the police is an invitation to be deported for you or your family members or your friends. If victims of crime and if witnesses to crime are afraid to cooperate with local law enforcement, then our entire public safety system will break down.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Hartford, Connecticut.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers.
What they do is matter in your face.
You gotta love Chris Christie, and you know, that's the frame that they try and put out there. Oh, we care about those teachers, but not those teachers who are in unions. And they do a masterful job of trying to divorce the two. They've done a masterful job of divorcing citizens from their government. They're trying to do the same thing with teachers and their unions, because after all, the unions are the teachers. Little fact that they try to get you to forget. Our education quote of the day from Sheehan Barrett, a guy we've had on the program, a Chicago teacher on the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. He says, remember that this isn't an ideology or about being at the table. These are corporate voices making money bathed in children's blood. And you know, over the last year, we've heard an awful lot about this group, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. And finally, people are paying attention to the power and the influence that this extremely well-funded, secretive group wields with our public policy people. And last week, ALEC held a closed-door task force meeting, if you will, to decide, well, its education policy. More importantly, I guess, it's deciding where they're going to spend the big money to push our education system. And Sabrina Joy Stevens, a teacher-turned-activist, now the leader of Voices from the Classroom Project for the American Federation of Teachers, she got into that ALEC meeting. And I've got her here now to talk about that. Sabrina, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I look at this group, and a lot of people up until about a year ago, nobody had an idea of who the American Legislative Exchange Council was. It was just some nice, wonderful little thing, and how much power they've got. I think now people are waking up.
Absolutely. You know, I think it really, you know, it's sad that it's taken such stark examples, but I think really the big game changer was when we saw the clear connection between this organization and what happened to Trayvon Martin.
Yep.
And, you know, that's really, I think, has been the thing. And now we're looking at how these policies affect us across the board, not just in these particularly egregious cases.
Stood up and you said, hey, you know, I'm underrepresented here. Probably I'm the only teacher in the room. You guys are trying to figure out what you're going to do with education in this country. And the guy kind of talked down on you. You said that you didn't understand. Well, here's the clip of him talking at you.
Yeah, because I don't think you understand the process here at all. Because these votes are taken separately. And these policies are then forwarded to the board of directors, which are all public members. The public members' board of directors have to approve these policies for them to become policies of the organization.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you don't understand at all, do you?
I think that, you know, I think what they're really afraid of is that they're realizing, or hopefully they're starting to realize, that we understand a little too well for their sake how these policies or how this process works. Unfortunately, when you have our state elected officials sitting side by side with corporate lobbyists who have wined and dined them, who have paid for them to be there, who are paying for them to travel around the country, like, with them for these events. You know, we know that's not a fair fight when we then, you know, show up at, a city council meeting or a state legislator, you know, state house. That's not fair. So we're saying, yeah, we do understand this process, and it ain't working for us. And that's why, you know, I and, you know, hopefully more people are going to start confronting them about this.
Yeah, when I saw that you were actually a teacher, someone who was in the classroom, because I'm waiting for the profession as a whole to stand up and say enough of the attacks, enough of the personal attacks, enough of the attacks of the profession, and enough of attacking the entire system by privatizing. I'm waiting for folks like you to stand up and say enough already.
Yeah, and
in mass. I mean, not just you, but I mean in mass, the entire profession at some point.
Absolutely. And I hope to be able to help catalyze that change, because, you know, I think what we need to realize is that, you know, we have such great ideas. We are always talking about how do we improve our schools and our community. Because the other thing too is that this isn't just about schools. This is about a much bigger picture issue going on in our society. But, you know, as long as these guys get to sit and, you know, have privileged access to our government, as long as these lobbyists get, you know, an all access pass, whereas the rest of us just get, you know, the basics, like, or even that, then when we have those ideas, we're never actually going to be, you know, our ideas won't get to compete on a level playing field. We're always going to be showing up at school board meetings to challenge a proposal, and the deal's already been made. We're always going to be showing up at the state house to do our lobby days when they already know how they're going to vote, because somebody paid them a vote that way. And so that's what I think, you know, really needs to change. That's the missing piece here. So we've been speaking out. We've been, you know, rallying. We've been creating our own proposals. We've done all that stuff. But we need to make sure that when we do those things, we can actually participate in a real decision-making process, that we're not just participating in charades. Democracy.
Yeah, my favorite is the, you know, they go to these conferences that Alec holds, and Alec hands them a whole bunch of model legislation, and they come back diligently and they put those pieces of legislation on the docket. I mean, I look
yep.
at Florida, for instance, where the woman she wasn't even smart enough to change the name on the top of the docket, actually put it in with Alec's name on it.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, for him to sit there and be like, well, actually, they all vote separately. No, I just watched them sit there, vote side by side. And, yeah, they voted it sequentially. But, you could, like, I actually heard how the private members who voted after the public members did, they outnumbered them in the room. You could hear it. And so I think that's the thing that really, you know, we understand very well how this process is working, and that's the problem. They're making policies based on, you know, responsive to these lobbyists who are flying them around the country. They're not listening to us.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I mean, in your work with this, is it possible for those people in the room to care about my kid? I mean, because the way I see it is, you know, the folks probably sitting in that room are more worried about their bottom lines and about their profits than my kid or any of, you know, my kid's friends in their classroom or my local school district or any of that. It's more about, hey, how do we make a buck in the next quarter?
Well, I think there are definitely people out here who, you know, very clearly are driven by profit. Like, profit is very corrupting in this process. I think there are people there who do care about children, who do care about all children, but the problem is they're not qualified to make these kinds of decisions. They don't understand our communities. they're, in many cases, the very people who are making it almost impossible for us to participate in the rest of our democracy that would help us actually build, you know, a society that supports good schools and schools that could support a really truly democratic society. And so, you know, whether or not they care is almost irrelevant. They just don't know what they need to know in order to make good policies, especially if they're not listening to those of us who do.
Yeah, I can see that point, and they're in their little world, and I think you made that point in the video that has made its rounds over the internet, that, you know, you as a teacher and the profession, horribly underrepresented, and would it be safe to say you were probably the only teacher in the room?
Oh yeah, and the thing about it too is, you know, even getting beyond like sort of just represented, like, the reason that matters is because when people, you know, they have no idea. They literally cannot, they can't fathom what it is that really creates barriers to both our participation in all of society as well as, you know, what's going to create barriers to putting good policy and practice in classrooms. They don't see all the good things that are already happening in classrooms because they're not there. They assume that they know better because they think they're just inherently better than the rest of us. And that's the problem with people who are so far removed from real communities, from everyday people, making all the rules in, you know, rooms that are literally so closed off, it's hard to get out of the room, let alone into the room.
Yeah, I saw the video. You had a very difficult time getting out of the room. And then again, you know, the part of me thought they locked the doors to keep everybody in so that they could accost anyone who dared question them, because there have been people who have been able to rarely sneak in as you were able to. How hard was it to get in, I guess, it should be the first question.
Well, I walked in and nobody asked me to leave, which was surprising. I guess, you know, putting on a blazer and trying to blend in works sometimes. That was really what I was trying to, I walked in and I tried to see how far I could get. I originally wanted to just share a really simple message outside, but me being a curious cat who will probably suffer the consequences at some point, I walked in because I was like, I need to know how this happens. This is my democracy, and I'm tired of not being able to make my voice heard in the places where it really matters.
So were you able to get a hold of whatever sample legislation or whatever policy that they were pushing those days? Because all I keep seeing is this push towards privatization and more charters and not school districts, but achievement networks and you know, very corporate type structure where profit is king.
Yeah, and the thing is like, you know, they basically had broadcast it all digitally. So they were showing it digitally. They hadn't really printed very much of anything. They were handing out these kind of like brochures from a lot of these right-wing think tanks and foundations, but there wasn't a lot of their stuff on paper, I'm assuming by design. But what's interesting is that it's a lot of the stuff they were talking about in the room that day is stuff they've already been doing. They're just talking about kind of how they're going to keep doing it, how they're going to keep moving it forward. And so what's the other thing is really, to me, was so insidious about it is that, you know, these are our, you know, state elected officials who've been flown into Washington to push, you know, they're supposed to be responsive to the specific constituents in their specific, you know, districts in their state. But here they are pushing this very national agenda and a very well-worn national agenda in Washington. That's what's really so strange and weird about it, is that we actually, you know, we see the playbook, and Alex Exposed in particular has done a great job of exposing all these different bills, because that's really what they've been doing. They're trying to figure out new ways to make sure they can get this in more state houses and make it look as though these are local policies when they're not.
Yeah, and it's well funded by the very wealthy in this country. And I go back
to
the fiscal mirage that we're suffering under right now. It's the same people that the Republicans want to keep giving huge amounts of money that they will in turn then use against us by funding groups like this pushing bad policy. I mean, it's this whole cyclic thing where I'm hoping that folks who are listening, and I'm hoping especially that teachers like you say enough already. We're going to raise taxes on those folks and we'll use that money, to fund education. So teachers like you have an opportunity to be in the classroom and have smaller classes so you can do the things that we know works.
Right. And then to take this even broader, and this is really what drove me there beyond even just the education piece, is ultimately we know, you know, especially as teachers, every social problem that happens in society shows up in our classrooms. And so when you look at the ALEC archives, they're not just, you know, rigging, you know, the education policy game against us. These are the same people who are really pushing, you know, these right to work laws that make it harder for workers to organize and get a decent wage. That means that when they can't, you know, they have to work 70, 80 hours a week, they're not showing up to parent-teacher conferences to be involved in their kids' learning. They can't. They can't necessarily read to their kids at night and make sure they've gotten a decent meal so that they can come to school ready and alert to learn. These things are all connected, and the, you know, that's what these people don't understand, or some people probably very well do understand. These things all fit together, and we can't continue to allow people to lock us out of every of all of our major political, economic, and social decisions and expect better results. They can't do it. They're not qualified to make these choices for us. We have to advocate for ourselves, and we need to take our democracy back.
Absolutely. It's that whole neoliberal push of deregulation and tax cuts for the very wealthy. It's all part of the system, as you've pointed out so eloquently.
Thank you. I'm still so amazed that I was able to keep it together, because I can't even remember the last time I was that angry.
See, and that's why I don't put myself in the situation. And if you want to see the video, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. But you know, I would probably grab somebody around the neck and strangle them. That's why I don't do that, because that's, you know, grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. That's what I remember. But, you know, here again, I give you nothing but the utmost credit for standing up and saying enough already. And I'm hoping that more teachers like you turn into activists and say, you know what, we're going to stand up and fight for my kids and the next generation of kids, so that everyone has at least a chance at a decent quality education in this country.
Absolutely. And I look forward to working with anybody who, you know, wants to work with me on how to do that. I look forward to just seeing more people really, like, more of us understand how it is that we really make our voices heard. We've got great ideas. We've got all the potential. We've got the drive and the passion. We need to make sure that when we're getting to, you know, the time to make decisions about policy, that we're actually making decisions and not just getting told what's going to happen.
Absolutely. And you can get a hold of Sabrina Joy Stevens on her Twitter account, Teacher Sabrina, is how you get to her. Last question I've got for you. You know, in the coming days, weeks, and months, we know the ALEC legislation will make it into state houses. What should we be doing? What should parents be doing? What should be our local teachers be doing to begin the process of pushing back against what we know is already coming?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the next couple of days launching a new project that's going to help unite people to do exactly that. The other thing is, I think, you know, we know now where this is coming from. We've dealt with this enough times. You know, we've been dealing with this for years, of these kind of rigged, you know, policy charades where, you know, oh, here's this new thing and it's coming to the state house at the very last second they show it to you. We know that this is coming, and we know where it's coming from, so now we can call it out. And, you know, I hope to see more people, you know, engaging at the state level, the local level, to call that out and to say, you know what, we want change in our schools that works for us. We want to make sure that you're hearing from us before you make these decisions, and we're going to do what we need to in order to make sure that we're the ones you're listening to, not the guys who fly you around the country and whine you and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's my vote, not their dollar.
Exactly.
That gets you in there. Sabrina, I appreciate the time. When you get that done, we want to have you back and get you to tell us where we need to be going and lead us in that direction.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thanks so much, Sabrina Joy Stevens. You can get her at Twitter, Teacher Sabrina. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we lie awake. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms: crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555
or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Now we must consider the forthcoming celebrations in Washington for President Obama's January inauguration. Really, we must. Unfortunately, we have to discuss this national, profoundly symbolic public event because Obama advisors are urging him to privatize it. They want him to let favor-seeking corporations put up tens of millions of dollars to pay for assorted inaugural balls, concerts, and parties. As Rob Wiseman of the always vigilant watchdog group Public Citizen succinctly says, this is a patently horrible idea. In 2009, Obama rightly rejected corporate donations for his first inaugural, but his advisors are now making a perverse argument that because this is a civic event, quote, corporate citizens should be invited to buy into the dance, just as they do when buying naming rights to public museums and ballparks. Come on, Obama. We'd expect Mitt Romney to allow that, but someone needs to shout out a loud no, not one step further to the rampaging commercialization of all things public. The inauguration of an American president is a uniquely public ceremony, symbolizing our people's commitment to the democratic transference of power. To stain that with crass special interest money is an insult to the very idea of America. And a corporate-purchased inaugural would be compounded this time because it'll take place on January 21. That very day will mark the third anniversary of the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United decree that corporations should be allowed to buy our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, if Obama does give in to the money, he should have to take the oath of office in a suit and tie emblazoned, like a NASCAR driver, with the logos of his sponsoring corporations. Tell Obama to keep his inaugural corporate free. 202-456-1111.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job.
You look at the American Legislative Exchange Council, business as usual, big money buying politics, big money pushing their agenda, which, you know, as I've been saying for the longest time, is not our agenda. We should be pushing for more opportunity for our kids, more opportunity for workers, instead of what we've been shoveled. And talking to Sabrina, it's just another example of why we need the sunshine and transparency, and we need to hold people accountable who are members of ALEC. And we've got a number here in the state legislature here in Pennsylvania. Let's go to the phone lines. I got John on line one. How you doing tonight, John?
I'm good, Rick. How are you?
Oh, I can't complain. What's on your mind?
Hey, listen, I just missed Sabrina there. I posted her video on my blog today, and it's my number one hit by far. And I just wanted to – I'm a school board member in Delaware.
Okay.
I'm on the largest school board here in the state, and I just saw how you ended the interview with Sabrina as kind of an invitation to come back and talk about where we are policy-wise, and I think that's the right place to go because I agree with everything that you have pointed out about ALEC tonight, but I have to tell you, the policies on the, you know, the Democratic and the Republican side, they're blurred somewhat there in the middle.
I'm with you.
And I think the Democrats have kind of, you know, left the progressive sensibilities behind. And I think that's what we need to get back to when we talk about educating the whole child and making policy that actually matches practice.
Now, I'm a huge fan of experiential learning. You know, I like the Montessori model. I think smaller classes with kids doing more, I think that's the right way. I think all of this drill, this whole test is a horrible thing, this idea that we get an education solely so that we have a job at the end is ridiculous. We're not training critical thinkers. We're training button pushers, and that is not good for a democracy.
Yeah, and I've been following Teacher Sabrina's work on the subject now for a couple of years. She's had a couple of different blogs, including one dedicated to failing schools, and she's she's at the forefront in, as far as an idea sensibility. Would love to call back in if she came on your show again.
Yeah, let me ask you this, John. You know, in sure. looking at education as a whole, how much more do you think teachers are going to take? I mean, I've been saying, my daughter came to me. My daughter's 10. She said, Dad, I want to be a teacher. I cringed at that moment. I'm going, you know, just a reflex of no, because I see how much abuse and I see how much nonsense goes on and these attacks at teachers. Do you get a sense that teachers are fed up and, like Sabrina, ready to take the action?
I do, and I'll tell you what, I think the tipping point is probably about 2 years away. And the reason I say 2 years is there are two joint consortiums, PARC and Smarter Balanced, that are developing the mother of all tests, funded by a $350 million portion of the Race to the Top money that Arne Duncan took away from that and put back into the test development, and those tests are going to start hitting states and schools in 2014, including here in Delaware, because we've already drunk the Kool-Aid on this. So we're headed down that path already. And when those tests come and reinforce the Common Core, which has been adopted by 45 states with its very narrow sensibilities in terms of what kind of curriculum you can use to support it, teachers are going to literally, some of the older ones are just going to simply say, that's it, I've had enough, and I'm going to leave.
I'm already seeing that.
And there's not enough to replace them.
I'm already seeing that. I mean, one of the teachers that my wife and I just adore was my daughter's fourth grade teacher. He's leaving at the end of this year because it's just enough already. I mean, it's no longer teaching. It's factory work.
And it's no longer fun.
Yeah, where each kid is this vessel, this empty vessel that you're supposed to, you know, insert knowledge into, and every kid's the same. It's really just this factory mentality, this industrial mentality.
And I got to tell you, the AST and the NEA have their work cut out for them because they have been alternatingly defiant and complicit in some of this policy stuff.
Yeah, well. At the end of it, it's going to take parents, it's going to take teachers, it's going to take the community to stop the big money, because it seems to me the big money is really behind this, to privatize education and ultimately to profitize it.
My district laid down on the tracks 2 years ago and raced to the top, and we got slaughtered.
Jeez.
So.
I appreciate it, John. Love to have you call back anytime and give us your insight. You know, but I look at this, and again, it's this whole push towards the profitization. And also, you know, and I like the George Carlin routine where, you know, he said, look, you know, they don't want critical thinkers. They don't want anybody to know how badly they're getting screwed by the system who threw them under the bus. What they're looking for is they're looking for people who are smart enough to push the buttons, smart enough to shuffle the papers, smart enough to do the work that needs to be done, but not smart enough to question why they can't make ends meet, why they can't support their family, why they can't lead the American dream like my grandparents' generation did. You know, my grandfather had an eighth grade education, probably the smartest guy I knew. Why? Because he had street smarts. He learned by experience. And I keep throwing that out as something we need to be pushing, this grill and drill, this, hey, you know, we're going to have the test, and we're going to have test and test and test, and these high-stake tests. It's horrible. Because what happens if you're in that first grade or third grade or fifth grade or whatever the tests are, and you don't do well out? What is that? I mean, you need to have measurable things, yes. But when the measurements are these cold, dry, clear-cut tests that, wow. It's a ripoff, isn't it? And I guess that's the point. And the point is to use all of this Race to the Top money or whatever you want to call it, all of the AYP and all of this stuff, so that you can think about this for a second. They set the system up to where if you're struggling, they take money away from you. If your school district is having a tough time because maybe you have a high poverty rate, or hey, maybe you've got, you know, some problems within, we're going to take money away so you have more problems, so you magnify it. To me, that's a recipe for destruction. You know, instead of doing the hard work that we know has to be done, well, destroy it and then profit from it. And I'm telling you, look at the Chester Upland School District. Take a look at what's going on there. That is the model that's going to be replicated all across this state. And I think John's right. I think it's going to be about 2 years. I think it's going to be, it's in the short term, where we're going to see all this stuff come to a head. And hopefully we'll be prepared. Hopefully there'll be the organizations and the people, the boots on the ground to defend it. Because my kids still, I don't know about yours, but my kids still got several years of public school left to go. And I want them to be critical thinkers. I want them to have opportunity. And I want your kids to have it as well. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
They might not go out and buy a shiny sports car, but chimpanzees and orangutans can experience a midlife crisis, just as humans do.
That's according to a study published in late 2012 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It suggests that, as in humans, chimpanzee and orangutan happiness follows a U-shape that is high in youth, falls in middle age, and rises again into old age.
A team of primatologists and psychologists from Japan and the United States studied 508 great apes in zoos and sanctuaries across the world. Keepers, volunteers, researchers, and caretakers who knew the apes well were asked to assess their well-being. The apes' happiness was scored with a series of measures adapted from human subjective well-being measures.
The researchers are trying to understand why human happiness follows an approximate U-shape through life. They said their study of apes showed that it can't just be because of mortgages, marital breakup, or mobile phones. Apes also have a pronounced midlife low, and they have none of those.
The team points out that their findings don't rule out the possibility that economic events or social and cultural forces contribute to the well-being U-shape in a human lifespan.
But these researchers say their study suggests a need to consider evolutionary or biological explanations as well. That's our show for today, made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
I gotta tell you, if the Employee Free Choice Act would have gotten passed, as I had hoped that it would, one of the first things I thought the Obama administration should have pushed through, Lilly Ledbetter was nice, But you want to make sure women don't get cheated on the job. You want to make sure that you solve that problem before it starts. Give them a chance to organize. Give people the chance to have a contract like just about every CEO in this country has. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. And, you know, going to that idea of an Employee Free Choice Act, one of the things that I liked about it is that, you know what, we're going to have a timetable between when you file for an election and, oh, by the way, when it happens. This idea that you'll file for the secret ballot election that the Republicans love to tell me that they're all in favor of and the time that it actually happens should be a reasonable amount of time, a couple of weeks. Should not be almost a year. And I look at this situation at American Airlines where CWA filed for an election last December. And just now the ballots are being sent out. Almost an entire year of delay. And I've got Mike Lavolo, CWA organizer from Dallas, also a former American Airlines employee. I got Mike on the line. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey there, Rick. Good to talk to you.
Is this right? Almost an entire year of stall and delay?
It'll actually be a year on December 7th that we filed, and tomorrow to the eligible employees, the voting instructions will go out in the mail.
I'm just, you know, I keep hearing people tell me, well, we don't need any help to our labor laws. Things work just fine. Here, how did this happen? How did you get to a point where you file for an election and it takes almost a year?
The transportation industry, railroads and airlines, come under the National Mediation Board,
right,
the Railway Labor Act, which are different in many aspects than the National Labor Relations Board. And under the airline industry, up until February of this past year, you needed a showing of 35% of your eligible unit, a minimum of 35% of your eligible unit, in order to file and call for an election.
Right.
We filed with well over 35%. We weren't with much more than 35%, and filed. And after you file in this industry, you don't get a list before filing. You don't get the list until you actually file. And of course, the list shows up with people who are in situations that were furloughed. We had deceased employees on the list. You file for the election, and the union and the company, through the National Mediation Board, battle the eligibility list. And that battle took until April to get it cleared up. And in the meantime, in February, Congress passed the Federal Aviation Reauthorization Bill passed,
right.
And the Republicans tacked on to it some union language, which stated under National Mediation Board, the new rules would be you need a minimum of 50%. And so when the election was set in April, after the list battle was complete and the election was set and a date was set, the company had said that they were having technical difficulties mailing the labels in. It took a two-week delay, and just before they were due the second time around, a lawsuit was filed in federal district court here in Fort Worth, Texas. And American was filing, they claim on behalf of their employees who don't want a union, that the law should have been retroactive. We all know laws aren't written retroactively. It's kind of hard to enforce a retroactive law. And because we had filed by the deadline, it went to that court. Here in Fort Worth, where American Airlines naturally is home of AMR, the judge found in their favor and put a stay on the vote, on the election, and by suing the National Mediation Board. So they sued the National Mediation Board for going through on the election, and the NMB filed an appeal. The appeal was heard in New Orleans, Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We won that, but that case didn't come up until October 1st.
So while all this drudgery is going on and all of this legal wrangling and all of this stuff's going on, you've got thousands of employees, you've got thousands of workers who have said, hey, I want to be represented by the CWA union because I want somebody looking out for my interest. What's happening to these people who have said, I want this representation? What's going on with them?
Well, the bad thing was since the Frank Lorenzo days of Eastern Airlines in the 70s, late 70s and 80s when I get into the industry, the way to bust your unions at the airlines used to be that you file bankruptcy. And through filing bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge could throw out a union contract at the flip of a switch.
Which they still do usually.
And those laws changed in the late 90s. Those laws, as more airlines filed suit, those laws changed. And in bankruptcy court, you have what's called Section 1113 bargaining. So the bankruptcy court judge can force the unions to sit down and bargain again through the bankruptcy process to come up with an agreeable contract, which is approved by the bankruptcy judge. Had the agents won their election, there's a chance we possibly could have been sectioned in under 1113. But by delaying it, when the company went to the courts with what they wanted to give to the agents, the judge basically says, do what you want. They don't have a contract, so it doesn't matter. So this entire time, unfortunately, many agents that have been around the company, some of them more than 30 years, your passenger service representatives, which were the red coats at the large airports helping people check in, your cargo agents, their jobs were outsourced and put on the street,
jeez,
not allowed to put in for other positions. And lots of the work that the agents do at airports were outsourced to third parties. A lot of these third-party operations that are being run by former managers retired from the airline industry, who are, you know, using their health care benefits from the airline while running another company, doing the job that agents were paid $21.50 an hour to do for $7 an hour.
Jeez,
and
man.
So a lot of those people put on the street, and it's in a lot of cases, it's too late for many of the agents that wanted the union.
And there's no way of going back and repairing that at this point.
If these agents took, they were offered choices, and if you had protection, which was if you were hired sometime prior to the 90s and you had what was called the job protection, you could take a package that would give you severance, and the company offered a $10,000 in order, an additional $10,000 if you were full-time, $5,000 for part-time, for you to leave the company and waive your recall rights. Under the NMB, if you're on furlough from the airline, for the length of your recall rights, you still have the right to vote. But, of course, American wanted those folks taken off the roster.
And were they successful in that?
Some yes, some no. We're still battling that portion of the list. There were some folks that really feel strongly about having the union and want the chance to fight. But in the current working situation, these companies know exactly what people need, and they need money to survive while they're out looking for other jobs. So a lot of people were stuck having to take the severance package in order to have money to live on while they're out looking for other work.
Jeez, oh, man. Yeah, and that's just... Well, I guess it's what you would expect in corporate America today. And, you know, you look at American Airlines went into bankruptcy. You know, what have they done since they went into bankruptcy? What have they done to the employees? As I understand, higher health care costs, lower wages, benefits being stripped away. I would say the exact reason why you need to have representation.
Exactly. Exactly. In cases of airlines, U.S. Airways, for example, which is another place where we represent the passenger service folks there, they had a hard time as well. I mean, American is basically the last airline in the industry that has not filed bankruptcy. Some of them have filed twice. U.S. Airways, we had protections through the Section 1113. The company showed up in court, and they said they wanted their agents cut from what was $21 an hour back in 2004 to $13.50 an hour. They wanted them to pay fully for their health care costs. And through Section 1113, they were able to bargain a concessionary contract. But one of the smart things that we did at CWA with their contract was, before we signed it, we were able to get the company to agree to a snapback provision, which meant everything that we gave up in 2005, whether or not a new contract had been negotiated, because under NMB, your contract does not expire.
Okay.
It only becomes amendable on the date that it's up, which means you continue working under this old contract. Another reason why these airlines take 4 or 5 years to bargain a new contract, the one you're working under currently is still good.
It's just eaten away by inflation.
Exactly. So you don't take any cuts, but, of course, you don't move ahead. However, without that contract, there's what's going on with the American agents now. They're taking cuts. The other union groups that gave things up sit where they're at in that contract until they better themselves, which they were all able to negotiate some things, not where they wanted to be, but a lot better off than the agents in American without a union.
Yeah. You know, I look at American and I ask the question, you know, since they're in bankruptcy, You guys, it's kind of a unique situation because you get to then see how much money that this supposedly bankrupt company is spending on denying their workers the right to associate with their union and with each other. And I'm curious, you know, how much money has Americans spent trying to take this right away?
I'll tell you, up until October 1st, which is the new fiscal year, you can go to the bankruptcy website and see any corporations that America owes more than $50,000 to, if pays for, I believe it's $50,000 a month, they have to file in bankruptcy court what money they're spending. And from December 7th of last year up until September 30th of this year, not even counting the last two appeals that they've done, well over $2 million that they've paid bankruptcy lawyers. The first 42 days leading up to us filing, they paid the union busters over $400,000.
Wow.
To put a program together and train their management team in how to be successful in breaking the union and not letting the vote go through.
And here again, I go back to you look at all the money that we've given to the very wealthy in this country and how they end up funding groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council. So the money that we're giving back, we're giving to them, they're using against us. The same example here, the wage concessions that the employees were taken from them, used against them to lobby. I mean, it's just, it's horrible.
Right. Right. I had a case, we had a buddy actually that worked as a flight attendant, and that's a professional job. They've got safety of passengers on board airplanes, who had gone to work for one of Delta's commuter carriers, ASA, which they just recently closed down. And that commuter carrier, which there were union jobs, but there were regional airlines. When you come in to meet with your supervisor to talk about how well the job was going and whether or not you're going to reach probation, supervisors reached into their drawers of their desk. They'd ask the employee, do you live alone? How are you making ends meet? And they'd say, on $1,500, $1,600 a month base pay with me being on reserve, how do you think I'm making ends meet? They would literally pull out and hand the employee a food stamp packet so that they could apply for food stamps because they were eligible working for these Fortune 500 companies.
Jeez. And, Alan Grayson said Walmart was the biggest welfare recipient in the country.
Right.
Sounds like we've got a number two contender.
Right, right. And, I mean, Walmart being the largest employer in the world, it's ridiculous. I was in those lines here for Black Friday. Here we, had some strikes at Walmarts around the country. But if you look at a corporation like that, I read a story last week where that family has more money than the lower 46% of this country.
Yep.
And, they're worth over $109 billion, and they can't afford to give their people health care, or the health care that they provide to their people the people can't afford it at the wages that they work at.
Well, I mean, the company can afford it. They just won't because they don't have to.
Right.
And that's where it takes people like you. It takes people like those Walmart workers who took to the streets, the fast food workers in New York who took to the streets. That's what it takes. It takes us to say no more. We're not going to put up with this, and we're going to join together and fight back. And I think what you guys are doing is fantastic. I understand the ballots have been sent out. When do they have to be back?
We actually don't ballot vote under the NMB any longer. Since anthrax in 2001, they've gone out to a different system, and
okay.
They've gone out to a system which is each employee who is eligible, and the eligibility will be battled back and forth between now up until 1 week before the vote's over. We'll count ballots on January 15th. It's now electronic voting, so each eligible person will receive a voter identification number, and they'll receive a PIN number, and with that number they either sign on to the NMB website or dial a toll-free number, and they call their vote in. And there'll be an option to vote for the CWA, which we hope they all do, an option to vote for a second union, or an option to remain union-free. In this industry, up until, I want to say, 2 or 3 years ago, which we fought and fought for years, there never used to be a way, and this is why they lost their second election, which was in 1998. If you did not mail a ballot prior to this, you were counted as a no vote.
Right.
So if you were dead and the union didn't catch it, or if you no longer worked for the employer, or if nobody had your proper address, any ballots not returned in the mail were considered no. So if you decided to stay neutral, you were actually a no vote.
Right.
Now the voting is done, and it's really funny because some folks in Congress, especially the Republicans in Congress, when they talk about this fair secret ballot election, they liked that idea. And the way that they've got it rigged now, if any politician in Congress, and there's not one today who was voted in with more than 50% of their registered voters, that's what these airline people have to go through. They have to get signatures from 50% just to call for an election.
Right.
An elected official needs to get a few thousand signatures to go on the ballot, and whoever gets the most votes wins that election. That's not the way it is here, yet these politicians think that's the fair way to do it. If we did it that way in Congress, we wouldn't have a Congress today.
Yeah, and I told the Democrats when we were fighting through all of that, I said, you should propose that. Say any person who's registered and doesn't vote, that's an automatic vote for the Democrat. And I don't know many Republicans who would go for it. Anything we can do in the coming days?
I mean, the holiday seasons are coming up, which make it very difficult. The airlines, our last election was held over the holidays. This is the busiest time of the year for airline employees. They don't spend much time with their families from Thanksgiving right on up till New Year's. We know how many folks, millions of people are traveling. Anybody that's traveling on American Airlines, if you're at a station, number one, make sure it's a station that's not run by a third party. And if there are actual passenger service agents at the gates, at your baggage service is all outsourced, so it doesn't matter now, but at the ticket counters and gates, talk to these folks. Let them know that you're behind them, and to call their votes in as soon as they get their voting instructions in the mail, because it only takes one snowstorm these days, although, of course, here it's 80 today, and I heard it's warm up there. It only takes one snowstorm somewhere in the country to mess up the entire airline system.
Yep.
So we want these people, when the weather's good this week, as soon as they get the ballots, to go ahead, call their votes in. And those of you who are traveling, offer support for these agents at American. And people need to realize the more folks that are union in any industry, which is the problem in this country now, the more folks in the airline industry who are union, the higher they keep wages and standards for everybody in the industry, whether they're union or not.
Absolutely. That's the line we preach. Michael Avolo, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Best of luck to you. CWA organizer there in Dallas, also a former employee, something that they called, the American called him disgruntled. He didn't sound all that disgruntled to me. Sound resolved. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Dig at Mr. Harnigan Hall, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Mr. Tap and Dig at Mr. Harnigan Hall, and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Tap and Dig at Mr. Harnigan Hall, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms: crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag.
Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Your Working Class Radio Experience.
Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought
are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living. Rick shared a farm and rent. Father son left a cameo. Blue denim had his vape. Oh, 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 he's a working class man.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, he talked about the Walmart family there a second ago, and our stat of the week from the Too Much Online blog points out that the four top errors of the to the Walmart fortune, you know, the Sam Walton fortune. They've crashed the $100 billion barrier. Christie, Jim, Rob, and Alice, the sperm lottery winners, they ended last week with a combined fortune in excess of $110 billion. And you go back to what John said there a second ago, and they could pay all of their workers about 30% more, even the CEO, and still lead wildly lavish lifestyles. But they don't have to. There's no force that makes that happen. The only thing that's ever made that happen, the only thing that said, you know, that's made employers pay a decent living wage, are people saying we're not going to do it for those crummy wages. You know, you stop and you think about what happened last week in Bangladesh, 112 workers at a Walmart supplier, dead, locked in a factory, burned. Those factory workers, those garment workers, they make as little as 21 cents an hour because they don't have the power to stand up to the Walmarts of the world. And soon, I'm telling you, we won't either. Once we give the wealth class all of the power and the ability to dictate, they will. It's that simple. Andy sent me an email during the break, said the top marginal rate should be 100%. He said the rich owe us. They owe us big time. He said we can give them the first $3.2 million at a lower rate, and then after that, start reducing our deficit that were caused by their ex-president's pension for going to war without the forethought of paying for it and killing roughly 5,000 lower-class kids to boot. He says it's time for P.D. Peterson. It's time he pays up what he owes this country for his lavish lifestyle. And I would say the billionaire class as a whole. We have made sure that the handfuls are well taken care of. And then we point our fingers at people who are just existing and saying that, well, they're lazy and shiftless. You know what this recession has done for a lot of folks? And, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet people who they've seen now both sides of it. And there's kind of an awakening. And I guess it goes back to that idea that, you know, sometimes your stomach has to be empty before your head gets right. And when it's you who has to, you're in a situation where I don't have a choice. I have to ask for help. It really opens the eyes. And I look at Cory Booker saying, oh, I'm going to take the week and I'm going to do the food stamp challenge for a week. Yeah, at the end of that week, he still knows. I'm going to be able to go back to where I was. What if that was the future? And you didn't have something to look to. You know, what if that was your reality? You know, it's always easy to take from others, isn't it? Especially those who are less fortunate. And I look at this Boehner proposal, going to cut hundreds of billions of dollars from programs from folks who are at the bottom of the ladder. That's the conservative way, isn't it? Going to take a quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you've got a smartphone, Stitcher. Quick break, back after this. It's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. It's going to be a bright,
conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A coalition of progressives, unions, and environmentalists is campaigning to change the U.S. Senate's filibuster rules, something Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid wants to do. President Obama supports Reid's efforts as well. What Reid has in mind is to eliminate the filibuster vote needed to officially start debate on legislation. Reid also wants to require senators who use the filibuster to actually spend it talking on the Senate floor. The Communications Workers of America supports the filibuster reform. Shane Larson is legislative director for the CWA.
The Senate can't even debate any bills anymore. They're not even allowed to bring up a bill for an actual honest, good old-fashioned debate. You know, the state that this country's in, with the number of issues that we have confronting us, our legislative bodies have to function.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is warning Reid that changing the filibuster rules would be toxic for bipartisan relations. It's not clear how that is any different from what's been happening already, with Republicans routinely using the filibuster to obstruct majority-supported legislation without having to exert any effort with marathon speeches on the Senate floor. Senator Reid says the reforms are just common sense. SEIU and other supporters are rallying around a Mexican man falsely arrested and now facing deportation under the Secure Communities Program. Melinda Tuhus report.
Members waved their purple and gold flags and chanted encouragement for Jose Maria Islas, a 34-year-old Mexican who was falsely arrested for stealing a bicycle and held for 4 months. Then he was released by a judge into the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which is trying to deport him under the Secure Communities Program. He is now charged with 2 misdemeanors and was held for an additional month in detention in Massachusetts. He still faces deportation, even though ICE's own policy is to target violent criminals and those who pose a security threat. Matt O'Connor, political director of the Connecticut District of 32BJ, which represents many immigrant workers in building maintenance, emceed the rally. First, he introduced Mike Lawler, Governor Daniel Malloy's criminal justice advisor, who has spoken out against ICE targeting of low-level offenders or those with no criminal record, like Islas before he was arrested on the false charge.
We're concerned because the perception in the immigrant community that cooperating with the police is an invitation to be deported for you or your family members or your friends. If victims of crime and if witnesses to crime are afraid to cooperate with local law enforcement, then our entire public safety system will break down.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Hartford, Connecticut.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Nongila Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons in the middle of the day. Now, sir, you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forget my name. In Youngstown, in Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, one of the things that I have a serious problem with the administration over is the direction of trade and the trade policy. I give the administration credit for standing up on some things, but this push towards more free trade agreements at a time when our trade deficit is through the roof just seems to me to be the wrong direction. But fortunately, I guess if you look at it this way, fortunately, this Trans-Pacific Partnership will be the last, as I understand it, the last trade agreement we're going to have to worry about, because this one, I guess, has this add-on feature. Well, we don't have to go through the negotiation process anymore. We're just going to be adding people to it, so it no longer do we have to go through this messy negotiation. It'll just be, well, the rest of the world will sign on. So Wall Street and corporate America can, well, line its pockets. This weekend there was an action. Evidently the Canada and Mexico have been added to this Trans-Pacific Partnership language, which is why I've asked Stuart True. He is the trade campaigner with the Council of Canadians and the coordinator with the Trade Justice Network. They've got a website, tppxborder.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Stuart's name. Stuart, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, hi. Hi, Rick. Thanks very much.
I'm looking at this, and as I understand it, this is going to be the last trade agreement we have to worry about, right?
Yeah, sure.
It's the end of it.
Until you end up in that new one, right, with the European Union. We've been seeing news about that, too, that's just around the corner for you guys. So maybe not just yet.
Yeah, but I look at this one. It's got this add-on feature that, you know, you just come join it without having to make any changes to the existing text. Everything just me too.
It's so simple, isn't it? It's beautiful.
So we don't have to go through this whole messy, you know, pointing out the fact that people like you and me and workers in all countries are going to be the ones who lose with these race-to-the-bottom agreements.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's really why we came together at the border, why the Washington Fair Trade Coalition invited Canadian and Mexican groups out to join us at the border there on the weekend. It was an amazing event. We had at least 200, maybe 300 people there talking about how are we gonna basically rally the troops against what is another, like you said, another, you know, dangerous bad trade agreement for workers and the environment across North America.
Now, I understand that the next round, I guess this will be the 15th major round of negotiations coming up. Our mainstream media here in the U.S. doesn't cover this. You're not going to see this on the evening news, I don't think. How is it covered in Canada?
Well, not much better. I haven't seen, I think, a single article about this round yet, even though this is the big one, right? This is for Canada. This is our first time in there. When it does get covered, a lot of times it's talking about how great it's going to be because it's going to help our government undermine policies. A lot of these, a lot of people favorable to these trade agreements don't like. And so for us in Canada, and this might not mean much for your listeners, but we have a pretty good regime for dairy, milk, and poultry, for example, where there's no subsidies involved, there's no taxpayer money at all that goes to the farmers, and yet they're able to make a living wage. Because they're able to trap a bit more of the proceeds of their labor, and this is actually something that, you know, New Zealand and Australian and U.S. Governments have been trying to get rid of through these negotiations. So we see these deals kind of coming, like just pushing the limits over and over again about how any of us can actually, you know, guide our own economic development, guide our own social development.
Yeah, so you got to worry that, you know, you're going to be rolled over kind of like the Mexicans were when we opened up NAFTA and how their entire farm economy was just destroyed by our big agribusiness.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Canada does a lot of rolling itself these days.
Sure.
I heard you talking about the Colombia deals, the Peru deals. I mean, we're right there, too, and you know, we're fighting those deals as well. But definitely when we see something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're involved right now. Canada's almost finished, actually, a major TPP-like deal with the European Union. And it really is about restructuring. It's really about clamping down, even now in our municipal government level. You know, this is something that, not sure if it'll come down in the TPP, but with this EU deal, they're actually going to block our cities from being able to prefer national or local goods when they're spending public money. And this is the first time, and, you know, I don't believe this is something that U.S. cities are blocked from doing just yet, but it could be down the pipes, right? I mean, this is something that municipalities here are fighting back against because they can see their hands are being tied and they don't see the benefits at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's not that we're blocked from it yet. A lot of our communities are just too stupid. because we've got this idea, well, it's cheaper. I mean, I've got friends who tell me, well, I shop at Walmart and buy all these Chinese goods because, you know, that Chinese labor allows me to live better. I go, but you don't have a job.
Exactly.
And the weird thing about all of this is, you know, you look at this agreement and what it's going to do is it's going to offshore. We're going to lose more jobs here in the U.S. I'm sure in Canada you'll lose some jobs from it as well. But more importantly for me, it's going to give Wall Street and the finance people much greater power around the world to do what they did in 2008, which is almost bring us the entire globe to its knees.
No, exactly. I mean, and that's really the point, I think, of the TPP. I think it's fairly obvious that if it did start off as being kind of a regional agreement, four nations, I believe, that started it off, including New Zealand, and now it seems pretty certain that it's being directed by corporate interests based in the United States. And you're right, it is, I think it is about offshoring. I mean, that's the goal, right? That's the goal of this agreement, is to make it easier for what do they do? They call it facilitating, supply chains or something like that, right? Which basically makes it easier to offshore production. They want to lock in the intellectual property, which doesn't create jobs. It just sucks up the capital right to the top. And then they want to clamp down on whatever any government can do in any of those countries to maybe direct things a little bit better, spread the wealth around. They want to be able to block countries from doing that. These are all of the many reasons people came by to the border action and committed essentially in a statement. We got a unity statement going around now that if anyone on the call is interested in signing up, say they're part of a community group or a labor organization, they want to sign this statement. It's up at tppxborder.org, and it's a baby step. It's a first step in what we hope is going to be a North American fight back against this trade deal.
Yeah, I'm hoping that there's some more push, but the sad reality is our mainstream media, and it sounds like yours as well, has not really picked up on this issue. And my fear is it will slide under the radar, because for me, I look at all of the stuff that, we get imported into here, that unsafe, with China especially. You look at the melamine and the baby food and the dog food and, antifreeze and toothpaste and all of these situations of toxic toys and the paint and that and all of this stuff where we really don't have, one, the ability to stop it from coming in. But according to these agreements, we're going to have very little chance to do anything by measure of law.
Well, I think there's some good news, and this is something that Arthur Stamoulis from the Citizens Trade Campaign, he was at the border event, and he said something that I thought was pretty inspiring. And we didn't have media coverage in 1999, right?
True.
When we protested to Seattle. Nobody knew what the WTO was. We let them know what it was. And the same thing again in 1997, 98 with the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. And it's always the case where we have to come back from the, from stage one and educate people and get them going. But at the end of the day, the WTO is stalled. It basically hasn't moved much forward since 1999. We've seen the Multilateral Agreement on Investment collapsed. I know there's 3,000 plus investment treaties around the world. And so it's not all a good story, but I think it shows the FTAA was another one. And I think the Free Trade Area of the Americas is a good example to take. That was one that just got too big. They added so many countries, it was unwieldy. And on top of it all, they just added the resistance of each of those countries to the mix. And the mix was toxic in the end for the trade deal. And so I have actually a lot of hope that we're not going to see a successful TPP negotiation like they want to do by the end of next year. And I have hope that it's going to be, citizens' movements that actually help to block that.
I hope you're right. With the folks that you saw on Saturday, because we've been following this for some time, trying to get information, and it's hard getting information. Most of this stuff's done in secret. We've talked to a couple of the lobbyists who've actually seen maybe copies of the agreement, and it's one of these things they're keeping really close to the vest. And it makes me wonder, if I can't see it, if we can't debate it, what's in it that's good for me? Probably nothing.
Oh, exactly. The days where they negotiate these things in secret, I think, have to come to an end. And the secrecy itself is attracting a whole new group of activists, I think, a group of people into the fight here in Canada. And I think it's the same in the United States. There's a lot of internet activists now, who take a look, and they're calling for things like open government already. They're calling for things like a free and open internet. And so when they see a trade negotiation that actually could potentially restrict the internet, they don't just attack those parts of the trade deal. They attack the secrecy behind the whole thing. Another good news story to look at from that perspective is in Europe over the summer, the parliament voted against the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. This other massively secret, 12, I forget how many countries were in that one, but it was defeated essentially because of these internet activists working against the secrecy, working with their politicians were able to get the thing defeated. And it's dead. I mean, this, just because one country as big as the European Union said no to it, it's essentially dead. And, you know, the United States had signed it, Canada had signed it, but they can't go anywhere with it now. And I think it's just another, you know, good story. This TPP is actually bringing people together in a pretty good way. They're not just talking about the technical details. I mean, you're right that it's secret, but I also feel like we know what's in the deal. I mean, right. We've seen the Colombia agreements, and we know they're just going to take that and then ratchet it up to the next level. So we gotta come at this on principle, and I think we have a great strength when we come at it, like you said, on the aspect of secrecy.
This is another movie, just a sequel to the original movies, the NAFTAs and the such. Let me ask you this, Stuart, because you know there's a movement of people saying, well, we need to have these free trade agreements because they create jobs, even though we know they don't, and it's cost us thousands and hundreds of thousands of, if not millions of jobs. Are we against trade? I mean, is this something that your group is against, this idea of having trade agreements, or is it just this kind of agreement?
I don't see how anyone can be against trade. I mean, it is the lifeblood of our economies, right?
Well, because, you know, if you're against this, you can easily be painted as someone, well, you're just against trade on all of these things.
Exactly. But, I mean, the easy answer for this one, I think, is, and I'm not sure it always convinces the people on the other side pushing that vision, but, I mean, these deals aren't about trade. Their tariffs are very low on most products, you know, into the TPP region. There's some exceptions. I know in Canada there's exceptions like lumber, for example. We export lumber, and there's some moderate tariffs into Australia and New Zealand on lumber. But, I mean, apart from these small examples, there's very few barriers to doing trade with these other countries. So we can just say these aren't about trade. These are about really constraining what we can do as nations or even as local communities now as they kind of creep down to that level. So, of course, we're not against trade. We'd love to be trading so as long as it's sustainably, as long as we're improving, you know, that we're diversifying our economies, improving the job mix, you know, creating good jobs and having some say in the kinds of jobs we're creating in the United States or in Canada or in Vietnam, for that matter. And the deals just simply take away those options. They take away the options that the people have to develop the kinds of jobs they want to produce.
No, I'm with you on that. Again, tppxborder.org, the website. Stuart True, trade campaigner with the Council of Canadians and a coordinator with the Trade Justice Network. Stuart, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Rick, thank you very much.
Anytime. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Now we must consider the forthcoming celebrations in Washington for President Obama's January inauguration. Really, we must. Unfortunately, we have to discuss this national, profoundly symbolic public event because Obama advisors are urging him to privatize it. They want him to let favor-seeking corporations put up tens of millions of dollars to pay for assorted inaugural balls, concerts, and parties. As Rob Wiseman of the always vigilant watchdog group Public Citizen succinctly says, this is a patently horrible idea. In 2009, Obama rightly rejected corporate donations for his first inaugural, but his advisors are now making a perverse argument that because this is a civic event, quote, corporate citizens should be invited to buy into the dance, just as they do when buying naming rights to public museums and ballparks. Come on, Obama. We'd expect Mitt Romney to allow that, but someone needs to shout out a loud no, not one step further to the rampaging commercialization of all things public. The inauguration of an American president is a uniquely public ceremony, symbolizing our people's commitment to the democratic transference of power. To stain that with crass special interest money is an insult to the very idea of America. And a corporate-purchased inaugural would be compounded this time because it'll take place on January 21. That very day will mark the third anniversary of the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United decree that corporations should be allowed to buy our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, if Obama does give in to the money, he should have to take the oath of office in a suit and tie emblazoned, like a NASCAR driver, with the logos of his sponsoring corporations. Tell Obama to keep his inaugural corporate free. 202-456-1111.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. There's a $1 million man. Always, it's his way.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Look at this trade agreement. Look, there's a lot of nastiness here. It's just like, you know, it's like the NAFTA, it's like the CAFTA, it's like the Colombian, it's like the, you know, the Panama and the rest of them. The reality is here in the U.S., we're going to lose jobs. It's going to happen. It's going to give the Walmart chain the ability to pit other nations against each other so that they can have the low cost, low regulation, low labor cost areas like Vietnam. I mean, I was just talking to a friend of mine who said, did you know Nikes are made in Vietnam? I go, where you been? It's been a couple of years that they've been making most of their things in Vietnam. And part of this trade agreement is going to open up more of that manufacturing so that, you know what? Even places like Bangladesh, who are 21 cents an hour, locking people in a factory, that's going to be too high cost. We're going to lose more jobs because of it. It's going to make sure that any sovereignty we have left, and again, you go back to through our trade agreements, you go back to NAFTA, you know, and there are tons of cases. There's, you know, the Charlie Tuna case where, you know, Mexico said, hey, California, you can't have a law that says, if you're going to fish for tuna, you have to use nets that don't catch dolphins too? No dolphin-safe nets. No. And we lost. Or you know, the other agreement with India where, hey, you know, that's an unfair barrier to trade, those smoking laws that won't let me advertise to kids. That's a barrier. We're going to sue you over that. All those problems are gone. Those are done. And what I love is you get people who are going, well, there's one world government. I don't know that I'm so much worried about that anymore. I'm worried about one world corporation, one world corporate power. And you stop and you look at all of this stuff flooding into this country. That we're going to have to go before an international body, a secret tribunals. Anybody who knows about NAFTA knows about secret tribunals, where you go in, you make your case to judges you don't know. Cases that, you know, most of us, again, never see. The fact that I can't know where the meat that I buy, what nation it comes from. You can only say North American. And if you listen to the Wendy's ads, they say made with real North American beef, because they can't say where it's from. Because obviously that would be injurious to Mexico, because I don't know many people going, oh yeah, bring me the Mexican beef. We're not allowed to know, because it's unfair trade barrier, evidently. So a law that we passed, nation of origin labeling, the international body has said, sorry, can't do that. And you think about all of the things that we're allowing to happen. This whole, and I remember one of the cases that Mexico brought against the U.S. to the tribunal that basically said Mexico should be allowed to dump hazardous waste in the U.S. because they're allowed to do it there. Because it's the least, understand what these trade agreements bring us, the least restrictive barrier. So if we're allowed to use child labor in our country, they're going to have to in theirs. If we're, now, there are some international laws that you're supposed, child labor being one of them. But hey, if you're allowed to dump toxic waste into the water, you can sue and say they have to there as well. And what you're seeing is you're going to see, as we open up these trade agreements, and especially this Trans-Pacific Partnership one with the Me Too clause, where everybody can just sign right on, you're going to see more attacks on our environmental laws. You're going to see more attacks on our health and safety laws. You're going to see more attacks on our labor laws. And had you elected Mitt Romney, we'd have had a territorial tax that had made sure that the profits could have been kept overseas, that were made overseas, brought in here tax-free. It would be corporate paradise. And, you know, the thing that's interesting to me is, you know, at a time when corporate profits are at an all-time high, they have never been higher than they are now. The third quarter earnings, $1.75 trillion, up almost 19% from last year. As a portion of the, as a percentage of our economy, they're higher than they've ever been. Ever. Ever. And then you remember when you were in economics class and you learned about the X graph, you know, where one goes up, the other one goes down, and, you know, as corporate profits have skyrocketed and they've never been higher, take a wild guess what has never been lower. Corporate profits, never higher. What do you think never lower has been? I'll wait. Gotta think about it. Yeah, you're right. Wages. Wages as a percentage of our economy, never, never have they been lower in the years that they've been keeping this. Corporations are making huge profits. And I love the argument, Obama's a socialist and he hates business. Corporate profits, corporate earnings, never higher. Never higher. Wages, never lower. That, to me, spells corporatist. That does, there's nothing socialist about it. Last year, profits, record profits. Stock market, one of the best performances that they've had since 1900. Obama's their guy. But, you know, the right still points their fingers. Socialist! Wages have now fallen as a percentage. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. As a percentage of the economy, 43.5% GDP. You go back to 1975 when it was almost half. When I look at the graph, it was at least half of our economy. At least half. 2001, right about half. 2001, right there. And now, down to 43.5%, and going down. And you can make the direct correlation right to the attacks on workers' ability to collectively bargain. You can make the correlation right to the ability of workers to stand together and say, we want a fair share of the profits. And then, you know, you can bring it into with the grand collapse, because you've got all these corporations who are wildly profitable. Earnings, never better. Profits, never better. Record profits. Are they taking those record profits and saying, here, thank you for all of your hard work, dedicated employees? No. They're doing a couple of things. They're buying back their stock so that their CEOs can reap huge windfalls. They're divvying it out amongst their handfuls of shareholders, their institutional shareholders. But it isn't being paid into the government coffers, because they're making sure that they spend that money using every single tax avoidance loophole possible, which is why, you know, at some point we have to say enough already, enough's enough. Which is why I like the fact that the National Nurses United, along with a number of other groups, not only here in the U.S., but across the globe, are pushing for this Robin Hood tax. And, you know, stop and think about it for a second. The common sense that goes into this. You know, when I go to the store and I purchase anything, there is a sales tax. And I got to pay that sales tax to go into the coffers to, you know, fund a whole bunch of things. Why is it that there's nothing on Wall Street that says, okay, well, if you're going to buy and sell, you should pay a small tax, at least to keep up the system, at least to make sure that you fund the cop on the beat so that, hey, you know, someone's paying attention so that it's a fair game. Thought? I mean, because I think it's a decent idea. And what National Nurses United and a number of these other groups who are calling for the Robin Hood tax, or simply it's a sales tax on the stock market. What they're saying is, well, hey, you've got this fiscal mirage. Before you start going after seniors, before you start going after poor people and all of this, you know, don't push seniors off the fiscal cliff. Tax Wall Street. That's their message. And on December 10th, in cities across the country, they're going to hold a candlelight vigil to highlight that, so that what you see is you see this push for the Inclusive Prosperity Act, House Resolution 6411, that would do just what I said, a small transaction tax, very small. And for me, what a small transaction tax would do, a couple of things. It would raise much-needed revenue so that we could have an effective SEC that would be the cop on the beat and be able to bring more regulators in so that we don't have a system that's collapsing. We don't have a system, as Alan Greenspan said, you know, we can't have regulators because they're not smart enough to oversee the derivatives. So the derivatives just went nuts and basically destroyed the world. But well, they're just not smart enough. We need more people on the beat. And we need to somehow figure out how to slow down this speculation. Slow down these supercomputers that are trading stock on fractions of pennies instead of saying, you know what, how do we invest in companies? What we're seeing is gambling. And the other part of this, along with the transaction tax, in my view, is not just, you know, the sales tax, but also saying, you know what, capital gains, that's income. We're going to tax it like the guy swinging the hammer, or the guy driving the truck, or the, you know, the woman doing teaching the class, or driving the truck, or whatever. We tax it the same. It's income. We should tax it at least, since it is gambling, we should tax it at least at the same rate that we tax lottery winnings. Personally, I think we should tax lottery winnings at a lower rate. Why? It's a lot harder to win the lottery. It's a sucker's game. I don't know why anybody would ever play it, but, you know, a lot of people enjoy it, and good for them. But we've got a governor who wants to privatize it. And in the coming days, weeks, and months, we're going to be talking about why it's a bad idea, and it is. It's a horrible idea. It's another one of these sweetheart situations where, you know, someone's going to make a whole ton of money, and guess who it's not going to be? It's not going to be you and me. We're going to be the ones end up holding the bag again. Because here again, and I ask often, show me a privatization scheme that has benefited working people. Show me a privatization scheme that has reaped profits for taxpayers, that has done what it was advertised to do. It's just not there. But the right keeps pushing privatization. They keep pushing deregulation. And they keep pushing the same tired, failed, old policies that have failed time and time again. Yet they've got the advertising money to tell us, oh, it's the one, this is new. It's kind of like the scheme that Kerry Benninghoff, the representative here in Pennsylvania, came up with, where the workers actually, who think that they're paying their state income tax to the state, actually it stays with their employer. And they call that new and innovative and different, just like 16 other states. Same bad idea, just a different name. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. You
Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Earth, sky.
They might not go out and buy a shiny sports car, but chimpanzees and orangutans can experience a midlife crisis, just as humans do.
That's according to a study published in late 2012 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It suggests that, as in humans, chimpanzee and orangutan happiness follows a U-shape that is high in youth, falls in middle age, and rises again into old age.
A team of primatologists and psychologists from Japan and the United States studied 508 great apes in zoos and sanctuaries across the world. Keepers, volunteers, researchers, and caretakers who knew the apes well were asked to assess their well-being. The apes' happiness was scored with a series of measures adapted from human subjective well-being measures.
The researchers are trying to understand why human happiness follows an approximate U-shape through life. They said their study of apes showed that it can't just be because of mortgages, marital breakup, or mobile phones. Apes also have a pronounced midlife low, and they have none of those.
The team points out that their findings don't rule out the possibility that economic events or social and cultural forces contribute to the well-being U-shape in a human lifespan.
But these researchers say their study suggests a need to consider evolutionary or biological explanations as well. That's our show for today, made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So the cliff, what's going on? Any new news on the end of the world?
Well, the House Republicans have made a new deficit to the proposal to the White House that calls for $800 billion in tax increases. Also, Medicare cuts and reduced Social Security inflation and adjustment. But I don't know any more details than that. So they have actually proposed something today. It's the first time they've had any specificity. So, again, $800 billion in tax increases, which, of course, is exactly half of what the president is proposing.
Of course.
So we may come in somewhere around a trillion one, a trillion two. If it's a real negotiation.
Sure. Yeah, a little give and take. It's a starting point. Question that I have is, where is that revenue coming from? Is it, this has been the party of the 2%, worried about keeping that top rate up there. What about the rest of us? Because I fear it comes from people like you and me.
Well, this is it. Exactly. By tax increases, what are we talking about? Because I'm looking at three or four different tweets here. Wall Street Journal breaking news calls it tax increases, and others are calling it revenue. So, it depends who you talk to, what you see it as. But it's very interesting. I don't know whether they are actually proposing a tax increase. I find it highly unlikely that they're proposing an actual tax increase. I'm sure they're proposing revenue, but it's possible that at some point they may come to the table with something. But I think they realize they want to get things moving. I mean, realistically, you've got to have some kind of deal on the table by about the 15th or a little later than that, because there are things that technically have to be done.
Right.
In order for the I's to be dotted, the T's to be crossed, and all the ducks to be in a row, in all sorts of different government entities, in Washington and all around the country, whichever way this goes.
Yeah, I mean, but, at the end of this, keeping that same line of thought, isn't it going to take time if let's say we go over the so-called cliff or molehill or whatever you want to call it, wouldn't it take time for them to implement all of that as well, and you could probably hold it off a little bit longer as well?
Quite possibly. You possibly could hold it off. And that's one of the options that I think that they are looking at, whether they can possibly hold everything off as well. Now, there were two very interesting reports this morning, one by David Korn of The Nation, that was then picked up and investigated further by Greg Sargent of The Washington Post. Korn reported, first of all, that according to senior administration officials, Obama is not eager to go over the cliff, but he is willing. If no deal is reached by the end of the month, all the Bush tax cuts for the rich and not rich will evaporate. And so Greg Sargent then looked into this, and he says, I have just confirmed that this is accurate. Obama is willing, albeit very reluctant, to go over the cliff.
Yeah,
which
I mean,
it's interesting.
Yeah, at some point, the Democrats are going to have to show that they're willing to go over the proverbial cliff, even if it's not really a cliff. What I love is for the last 4 years, Republicans have been screaming about certainty. Oh, we're not letting businesses have certainty. All of this being up in the air, it's not certain. Corporate America is pretty certain. They're taking their money now. I don't know if you've seen all of these corporations who have announced they're going to be taking their dividends at the end of this year instead of next year like they normally do, because you know what? They know at some point they're going to have to pay a little bit more.
Exactly. And I think they realize, that everybody is going to have to pay a little bit more. It's going to be a question of how that's going to get done.
Yeah. Well, we will see what happens. On some other fronts, what's going on? The internet, there's a lot of internet stuff talking. I understand a treaty being discussed in Dubai today.
Yes, this treaty is being discussed in Dubai, and this treaty is going to be discussed for the next several days. So there's a fair amount of panicking about this treaty. I've been reporting on this for some time. The U.S. is very concerned about it, along with the EU, because they're worried that there's a threat to the open internet. Google's very worried about it. Google's also worried about it because Google's even saying, look, you've got all these governments there, but what you don't actually have there is you don't have the internet there. Why don't you have us there, they're saying. We're the people who created it, and we're not even there. That doesn't make any sense. They're saying there's no engineers, companies, and people that build and use the web have no vote. One person who has even written about this is Vint Cerf, who's the computer scientist who co-designed some of the Internet's core underlying protocols and who now acts as Google's chief Internet evangelist. He said a state-controlled system of regulation is not only unnecessary, it would almost invariably raise costs and prices and interfere with the rapid and organic growth of the Internet we've seen since its commercial emergence in the 1990s. Because that's the concern that some of these countries want to do, that they either want it to be run state by state or they want to put fees on search engines, for example, and others going across state lines.
And the want to be able to turn it off and to be able to control the content as well.
Russia is certainly indicated that it's interested in using that. that says member states should have equal rights to manage the Internet. But a recent editorial in the Moscow Times pointed out that Russia's already been introduced a black list of banned sites without needing an international treaty. So they're already doing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Chinese, you know, doing the same kind of thing. I mean, it's, you know, Big Brother is watching, so...
But the one other point to remember about this, first of all, both the House and the Senate have both issued resolutions, you know, saying we want to look out for our interests here. The other thing is the U.S. does not have to sign this treaty. It's all voluntary.
Okay, good. Well, do you think we will? I doubt it.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, good luck getting any of those things because, hey, we might have online poker.
We might have online poker. This is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada, Bill.
No surprise there.
No surprise. No shocker. It's to ban all forms of online gambling except poker.
Ah, okay.
And so you've got lottery providers and convenience store trade associations at loggerheads because the lotteries don't want it, but convenience stores do want it.
Why would the convenience stores want it?
Because the convenience stores want people coming in and buying lottery tickets in the store.
Yeah, I mean, I would think they would be against the online poker, then.
Well, because if they ban everything except poker, it means that all the other games have to be played in the store.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah, and they had a lot of research showing that if you go in to buy $4 a lottery ticket, most people then spend another $5.
Yeah, good point. I mean, but I can't imagine sitting there playing online poker the whole time because, one, I don't see the cards. I mean, that's one of the things that bothers me. How do you know it's on the up and up?
You don't know it's on the up and up, exactly. And I would have thought, I'm not a gambler, but because my grandfather was a gambler, it put me off. But wouldn't you have thought that the excitement of it was stealing the cards? But apparently it's not. It's
yeah,
a huge
it.
Business.
Yeah, we'll soon see. Also, did you see over the weekend the shooting in Kansas City?
Quite extraordinarily shocking.
Horrible. Did you see the Costas's statement?
I saw it. I didn't see it happen because I don't tend to watch ESPN, but I saw what he said, yes. It seems to me that brain injury may be as much to do with it as anything else.
Yeah, you got to wonder where that's going to go. But, you know, boy, Costas is just taking a beating.
He really is.
Yeah, because, you know, it's one of those things, well, how dare he talk about guns? I mean, come on. Maybe the guy would have killed her one way or another, but the gun sure made it a whole hell of a lot easier.
It sure does. I mean, if you've got to stab somebody, you've got to put some real work into it.
Yeah, and then stabbing yourself.
Yeah.
Ask Artie Lang.
Yeah.
Sad stuff. Victoria, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
You could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name?
If you've experienced any of the following symptoms: crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555. Or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the first entrant into the 2016 presidential race, evidently coming out, looks like Alan West might be the guy. He was on a radio program, NPR, had him on. Person asked, hey, what's next for Alan West? And Alan says, look, you know, hey, God closes a door so that he can open up greater doors. He said, I'll continue to, you know, stand up and fight for this country. That's my goal, he says. He goes on to say, you know, and always remember, Abraham Lincoln only served one term in Congress. So, is Alan the next guy? Could it be 4 years in the running? Well, you need a job, right? I guess it's a little bit better than Tricky Ricky Santorum, who has landed a gig. That's right, he's going to be a conspiracy writer for World Net Daily website. They're kind of the, you know, the conspiracy blog, if you will, best known for some of its crazier headlines. You know, one of the headlines, Arpaio, probable cause, Obama certificate of fraud. Postman heirs family put foreigner Obama through school. Michael Savage, was Breitbart assassinated? And Obama's missing year at Columbia found. Yeah, so Santorum should fit right into that world quite well. Because, you know, you think of some of his views that homosexuality, you know, like bestiality. He told rape victims that they shouldn't be permitted to get an abortion, but you just make the best out of a bad situation. And said that food stamps aren't necessary because our obesity rates are so high. He should fit right in there with the folks over at the World Net Daily. So you'll want to look out for the crazy writings. Today, you go back in history, the folks at history.com have highlighted the fact that today, 1984, was the Bhopal Union Carbide disaster. They write in the early hours, one of the worst industrial disasters in history began when a pesticide plant located in a densely populated region of Bhopal in central India leaked a highly toxic cloud of methyl isocyanate into the air. They estimate 1 million people lived in Bhopal at the time. 2,000 were killed immediately. At least 600,000 others were injured. And of those 600, at least 6,000 have died since. They go through and basically it was a mechanical and human errors. I would, some would argue understaffing, not trained, all of that stuff, not knowing what it is you're working with, but, it is what it is. The Indian government sued Union Carbide. The civil case, according to history.com, was settled in 1989 for $470 million. And you stop and think about it, over 600,000 people were injured, 2,000 killed, all of these big numbers, $470 million, not an awful lot. So if you look at it, because of the number of people, most of the victims received about $550. That doesn't pay for all of the long-term chronic lung ailments, the eye problems, all of the psychiatric disorders, and common illnesses that were developed because of this, according to the folks at History.com. And the average death, people who were killed because of this disaster, the folks were compensated somewhere in the range of $1,300. Oddly enough, according to History.com, the Indian government still has not distributed roughly half of the original settlement. Now, understand, Union Carbide, as soon as it happened, they shut down the plant and they bolted. And to date, according to History.com, the site has not been cleaned up completely. And what you have is a rusty, deserted complex that to this day, according to them, continues to leak various poisonous substances into the water and into the soil there in Bhopal. And you stop and think about a lot of what goes on in this country. As soon as we finish this race to the bottom environmentally, regulatorily, as soon as we finish this and we get down to where these folks were in the 80s, because it's coming. Look, these trade agreements are going to bring us down there. This could be anywhere. And you look at the small $470 million, sounds like a huge number. It's not. Not when you look at the costs associated with this. And you know what? In a country like India, at this the way this is pointed out, it's not a big deal. Well, let's take the money and we'll use it somewhere else. And I've always said, it's the external costs. We the taxpayers, we the people, we the citizens, we the residents, we're the ones who bear the true costs of these disasters and all of this environmental degradation. It's you and me. They generally don't put a, what was the chemical again? Methyl isocyanate. They generally don't put those in the affluent neighborhoods, do they? And if they are anywhere near the affluent areas, I would bet you the mechanical systems that were in place would have detected a leak long before an hour passed. But here again, you look at this and that is the direction that we're moving. This whole deregulation, this whole push towards, well, less say by you and me. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership, this trade agreement, it's, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that we're going to get it, we're pushing towards another one. And the guy we talked to, Stuart Truce, he seemed somewhat confident, at least optimistic, that maybe there's a possibility of stopping this. And I'm hoping that's the case. Because you look at the past trade agreements. Have they benefited us? And I know there's some, we've got export jobs. Not as many as we lost in manufacturing. And we need to be looking at manufacturing in a whole different light. We need to be looking at it as a security, national security issue. We need to be looking at it in the light of, hey, we need to build our own bombs. We need to build the rivets that make our planes. We need to build the screws, and we need to make all of the products that go into our war machine. Why? Because, A, you need it, but, B, you need the capacity. But I guess, that's going to be a tough sell, isn't it? Especially when you're looking at the fiscal mirage. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, Stitcher on your smartphone. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and